Hello again, friends, and you are my friends, and welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast, the only podcast on Turner Time, The Mothership, episode 21, Blackjack. I am the great Brian Last, and with me, as always, is my co-host, the man who's got the gold, baby, Santo Gold, David Bixenspan. Bix, Santo Gold, how are you?
I am doing well, although I traded all my Santo Gold in for Global Force Gold.
You know, we got to start the show by talking about this. We've, the last few weeks, been talking a lot about Santo Gold. It's become an obsession of ours and fortunate for us, the listeners, as well. And, you know, wouldn't you know what happens in this weird world of wrestling? It seems that the gimmick of Santo Gold has been stolen by Jeff Jarrett. Can you explain a little bit about what's going on here? Because I got to say, more listeners have sent me this clip and this information than anything else maybe in the history of the show. Every day I'm getting tweets and messages on the Facebook page with people saying, look at what Jeff Jarrett's doing, Santo Gold, Santo Gold. So what's going on with this? What is this?
I don't know. Okay. It's it appears to be a pyramid scheme. So I guess the way people discovered it was someone, for some reason, was going to the Global Force Wrestling website.
Why?
That's why I said for some reason. And now when you go there, you get this giant popover ad telling you about Global Force Gold. And then that redirects you, when you click on that, to globalforcegold.info.
What exactly is Global Force Gold, though? Is it that he's selling gold, or is it that there's a specific type of gold, like, you know, Santo Gold had his Italian gold, that's Global Force Gold? Or what? I guess that's my confusion. What is it?
He's an affiliate with Carat Bars, which they sell like credit card type things that have a gram of gold in the center.
But holy shit, this really is right out of Santo Gold.
Oh, man. And it's all the usual blah, 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 buy high quality gold bullion investment, blah, blah, blah. But it's a pyramid scheme because Jarrett's an affiliate and it's affiliate marketing, and it appears to be a pyramid scheme as opposed to just multi-level marketing because they promise giant returns and stuff.
Who has ever said, you know, that Jeff Jarrett, I really wish I could buy gold from him. Oh, man. You know, he should use that money and make a movie. He can make a blood circus on a movie.
Yeah, he invites you to join Team Jarrett in a video. I'm not sure if we should play it. It's not long, but
what do you think?
The video is so vague that I think I need to play it for just at least part
of
it.
All right, real quick.
Hey, this is Jeff Jarrett, and welcome to GlobalForceGold.com.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, by the way, it's globalforcegold.info, and immediately he calls it globalforcegold.com.
He got the wrong website for his own website?
Yes.
Brilliant. Right out of Global Force. All right. Good job.
Right now, I'd like to congratulate you for taking about 20 minutes out of your day today to watch this special video.
20 minutes? Fuck you!
No. This video is not 20 minutes. The video he's telling us to watch after is also less than 20 minutes. But
oh, no. I was saying fuck you to him, not you.
I know.
Okay.
Real simple. I want you to learn more about what me, my family, my friends, and my fans are all doing to be a part of this special opportunity called Team Jarrett.
Oh, he's got everyone tied up in this.
Watch the video. Real simple. Just fill out the information below, click submit, sit back, and watch the video. What's the next step after that? Even more simple. You wait on a call from a member of Team Jarrett for you guys to discuss next steps. And also, we got to get some information, like your mailing address and how you want me to personalize the 8x10 autograph. Guys, don't waste any more time. Sit back, enjoy, learn about gold, and watch the video now.
Yeah, if you agree to get the call, he will mail you a autographed 8x10 photo.
I'd fill out the form on the Santo Gold website before I do that. And just fill out the form and wait by the phone. Wait by the phone for a Team Jarrett. That means it's either going to be him or his wife. Hey, you know, you sound suspiciously like Jeff Jarrett. Oh, no, I'm his roommate. I'm not Jeff Jarrett. I'm his roommate. So who should I personalize? Who should Jeff personalize the autograph to? Make it up to Santo Gold. Someone needs to do this and get them to call in and have them personalize an autograph from Jeff Jarrett to Santo Gold.
Oh, and then it has the arrow pointing down. It says, enter your info below and click a gold button to watch the 20, and then 20 is crossed out, 7-minute video with 7-minute underlined. And you have to put in first name, last name, phone number, email. You can put in whatever the hell you want, and it works. And there's also a phone number. I tried calling it. I made sure to turn on caller ID block because who the hell knows who I'm calling. And just went to some, you know, unlabeled voicemail. So it's a national phone number, though, so I presume it is someone directly involved with Jarrett. But, yeah. And I what happens if I ask for an autographed photo of Karen instead?
She may actually show up. If they think you got some money, who knows who will show up? Boy, they really must be hard up on money that they're doing this. He's got his friends, his family, and his fans all tied up in this pyramid scheme.
I really, really, really hope he didn't get his dad dragged into this now that they're reunited.
Well, his dad is sort of the brains of the family. I doubt he would. I hope he isn't involved in this. But anyway, we're going to keep on top of this story, even though it's a contemporary topic because Jeff Jarrett's involved. It involves a wrestler selling some sort of Fukakta gold, and that's right out of the Santo Gold playbook. So we are going to just keep an eye on this and see what's going on with
Fukakta gold, Fukakta gold, Fukakta gold, Fukakta gold.
Oh, man. And no news yet on our attempts to get someone involved with Santo Gold or Blood Circus on the show. The search continues. We're working hard on it, and a few of our listeners have actually hit me up and said that they were – someone actually filled out the form on Santo Gold's website and said, like, hey, you should do 605. So we'll see what happens.
Did they put in their
credit card number? God, I hope not.
Have you or has anyone else just tested to see what the form will recognize without actually putting in your name or anything?
I haven't.
That's probably something we should do. Just put in and see, like, if it – if you – it's probably like the form on the – Global Force Gold site, where if you put in anything that just can be a name, email, phone number, etc., it works.
After listening to last week's show, maybe we should put Joel Goodhart's credit card info in there, just like Dennis did.
That's not as easy to pull off today.
Moving on, we have a big update this week. This is going to be news to Bix, too, about the Slip House Boys.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, you know, I feel like in one way this may close the door on one part of their story, but in another way open another. I talked to my father again this week, and I explained to him, Dad, I'm doing this podcast, and I know you don't listen to it because you don't care about wrestling, but I talked about this ridiculous story you told me about seeing this match, and he was surprised that, you know, anyone cared. And I said, you know, we're on the search of figuring out who these guys are. We have a wanted poster, for Christ's sake, made by Travis Heckle, friend of the show, for the Slip House Boys. We're trying
Did
to figure
you explain
out
who Travis Heckle?
No, I didn't explain that to you. I said, do you remember anything else about the match? And then he hit me with, I remember that Putski won the tag titles.
Oh.
So I went back and I watched some Global. It's on YouTube from March of 92. And according to the records I saw, this was the only time he won the tag titles. It was supposed to be him and Gary Young, and it wasn't. Terry Garvin Sims took Gary Young's place against the Godfather's team of the California Connection, John Tatum and Rod Price. I didn't hear the word Sun, Fun, Slip, or House in the audio. But based on him saying it was a tag title match.
Well, tag title change.
Tag title change. That is the only possible match I believe it could be. So I think we thought it may have been even either them or Alex Porteau and Sean Summers.
The Beach Bullies, I think was their name.
I believe so. I believe we can now say for sure that the Slip House Boys in my dad's eyes were the California Connection of Rod Price and Hollywood John Tatum. But I feel like the Slip House Boys has become a much bigger thing now. So since I didn't find any evidence of them being the Slip House Boys, we're going to keep the Slip House Boys around as this mysterious tag team in our super universe. But I think that may be the debunking everything out there. I think that may be the final. We figured out exactly what my dad was talking about.
That's unfortunate.
I'm disappointed.
Well, it's also because it's who we were thinking they were in the first place.
It was. I was hoping I would listen back to the audio and I'd hear Craig Johnson say, you know, oh, he slipped, or he's got a big house, or just something with Slipper House, or even Sun and Fun. I honestly would have, I think, even enjoyed it more if he had said, here is Sun and Fun. And boy, what a great announcer Craig Johnson was. He never did anything else of note, but I really enjoy him in Global. And that's it.
I always liked Craig Johnson.
I did too. He has like a Keith Olbermann thing going on, you know, with the glasses and a big head. But a very, very good announcer. I really enjoy him there. But it looks like that's who the Slip House Boys were. But that's not who the Slip House Boys are. It's become a much bigger thing, thanks to everyone out there in our listening audience.
Oh, my favorite thing about Craig Johnson, though, or at least that I've ever seen anyone say about Craig Johnson, is when he made his debut on USWA TV and the Observer had a report from the TV taping. And Dave said something like, he was described as a cross between Vince McMahon and Hugo Savinovich, whatever that means.
Yeah, what the hell does that mean?
I have no idea.
He's not at all animated like Hugo Savinovich. He doesn't really carry himself at all like Vince McMahon. Who described him?
Maybe he looks physically like a cross between Vince McMahon and Hugo Savinovich.
But he doesn't. What the hell? Who is giving Dave? Who is Dave's source? That's before Eddie was there, so you know Eddie wasn't feeding him that.
Maybe it was the same guy who did the Texas Roundup newsletter? The mystery wrestler?
I don't know. That's a weird, I never would have thought of that as being what Craig Johnson looked like. John Horton, I believe, was his real name.
Yes. And still is.
Again, a shame that he never did anything else. I really enjoyed him as a commentator. Moving on, a couple of notes about upcoming shows here. We're going to probably do a piece soon about homophobia in wrestling. And the reason I decided that we should do this was when I was working on the video playlist a few weeks ago, and we had talked about Richard Charland. And I found a match with him from WWF TV, a house show match. I forget who it was against, maybe Lanny Poffo. And it's maybe Gorilla Monsoon and Lord Alfred Hayes, and they're hitting him with every one of those. Pat Patterson, School of Self-Defense, Terry Garvin, they're hitting him with all that. So I was like, you know what? We got to do something with just like all the times that wrestling has been blatantly homophobic and put it on the show. So we're going to get some audio stuff together and put that together for a feature. If not next week, you know, pretty soon. I don't understand the whole thing, Bix, of the Terry Garvin School of Self-Defense or the Pat Patterson School of Self-Defense. Are they saying that the wrestler is gay, or that the gay guy in the office likes them, or are they just making fun of him just to make fun of him? What exactly are they getting at? I've never quite understood that.
Well, I was never clear on if they are saying that the self-defense class is the gay sex, or if the Terry Garvin School of Self-Defense is how to learn how to defend yourself from Terry Garvin.
Yeah. I mean, we all know they've said these things, and we all know that Terry Garvin and Pat Patterson were gay, but I never quite understood what they're saying. Are they saying that Richard Charland was gay, or that Richard Charland, you know, or that the gay guys in the office would influence were interested in Richard Charland? It's just so confusing.
Well, I mean, they've said it about guys who, as far as we know, I don't think there was any involvement with. Like, I think they even said it about guys like Dusty Wolf, who I don't think had anything to do with them. So I don't really know. I mean, I guess with Terry Garvin, at least, and Richard Charlin, there was that whole thing where there were all the stories about Terry Garvin and how he would act towards people he would book, like, as far as Canadian guys as referees and the ring crew. And I'm guessing that also might have extended to the local wrestlers. So maybe it means that they were assuming that anyone who was a local Canadian guy was, how should I put this? Was involved with Terry Garvin, that Terry Garvin had interest in him. But yeah, it was usually, I think, Terry Garvin School of Self-Defense. And if they added anything, it was that Pat Patterson teaches go behinds or whatever.
I'm a graduate of the David Bixenspan School of Self-Defense.
What does that mean?
I don't even know. guarding against internet feuds, I guess, which I may or may not be very good at these days. It took you a second. We'll reference that again later on in the plugs. A couple other things about upcoming shows. So we're going to do a segment about homophobia in wrestling pretty soon. So if you have any suggestions or thoughts, you know what to do. Go to facebook.com/superpodcast. And you guys have been awesome. Whenever we talk about something, if it's something we solicit, you guys, you know, the commercials in wrestling, everyone threw a bunch of things out there. But just everything in general, you know, even though it's a small fraction of our listening audience that's on the Facebook page, it's a very engaged, very active audience. And I can't even tell you how appreciative we are for just how into the show you guys have been and how helpful you guys have been. You know, this show is done by me and Bix, but this show is really carried by you guys, and you guys make it all. You guys have made it all what it is now, which I think is one of the more, maybe the most interactive wrestling podcast out there, even though we don't take calls. And we're going to continue going down that road. So thank you, everyone. Next week, we're going to have part three of our talk with Bobby Simmons. It's really, really good. Everyone will like it. We discuss various talent and bookers that worked in Georgia, and he gives us his thoughts as well as funny stories about them. Everyone will really, really enjoy that. And it's going to be a four-part interview. Next week is part three. And we'll see when we want to put part four up. What I'm thinking is next week we're going to do part three of Bobby Simmons. The week after, due to popular demand, we're going to do the 1988 Dallas radio audio with Michael Hayes. Everyone enjoyed the 1984 audio with him as a heel. Now you get to hear him as a babyface and a single babyface, not married anymore. So we're going to do that in 2 weeks. Tell a friend, call somebody. That'll be in 2 weeks. And we're working on a few really, really cool Dennis's of the week. So I'll keep you posted on that, including one which wouldn't be an interview with someone. It would actually be playing some audio that I think everyone would lose their minds over because it's hysterical. I'm working on that. I don't want to say too much more about it. We have a few other people we're talking to and we're recording with even later today, actually. So you're going to hear other people mixed into the show the next few weeks, interviews, comments, thoughts. Stay tuned for that. I think we're going to have some really, really awesome things coming up that everyone's going to go crazy for. And with that, it's time for the top 10 for this week, Bix. The Super Universe top 10, as voted by the listeners on the facebook.com/superpodcast Facebook page. Surprise, surprise, Akeem Bixenspan voted out of the top 10. I was shocked. I was shocked by that. I got to be very honest with you. I was shocked, shocked and amazed by that.
You stupid idiot!
Me or someone else?
Everyone else.
Okay. Also voted out of the top 10. This one's really going to hurt Bix even more than Akeem. The Hangman Bruce Pohl Bands voted out of the top 10.
Are you kidding me?
Here's the top 10 for this week.
I think there's a recency bias going on, and I think some of the newer listeners need to go back and listen to some of the earlier shows to find out about Hangman Bruce Pohl Bands and Akeem Bixenspan.
Number 10. This one makes me
happy.
Thank
you for not selling that at all.
We'll see what happened. The listeners, I was shocked. I was shocked at the way the voting went this week. And I will say that the runoff votes for the tiebreakers had more response than the actual votes for the overall top 10.
Okay.
So we'll see how that changes this week.
If you say.
But number 10, Sex Appeal Ronnie Steele. And now we had a three-way tie. So this was broken up, and that's what will be 9, 8, and 7. Number 9. Wee Willie Wilson. Number 8, making his debut on the top 10, Fake Stan Lane. I was surprised by that one, Bix. I got to be honest.
Me too.
Number 7, maybe my newest favorite, Denim Fritz Von Erich. Everyone really likes Denim. Everyone loves Denim Fritz Von Erich. Everyone loves it. I had a funny thought this week. I was driving around, and I was just, for some reason, I thought of that audio you played a few weeks ago of Chris Von Erich singing. What if there had been a Fritz Von Erich album, like in the early 80s, to capitalize on the mania around the Von Erichs, just like Fritz Von Erich singing the songs of the day.
And or instead of my dad can beat up your dad, just I can beat up your dad.
Let me see. Can I do my Fritz? Fritz is actually harder on my voice than anything else, even in the Black Scorpion, believe it or not.
Wait. That's you doing the Black Scorpion?
Sometimes, maybe. Sometimes it's me. Sometimes it's Ole. We go in and out. Ole Anderson's been on the show like so many times, no one realizes it.
What kind of name is Ole anyway?
Yeah. Another reference to episode 3 or episode 2. I forget which one that one was. Maybe episode 2. As pure as New York snow, she's got Betty Davis eyes. We're going to rock down to Electric Avenue.
What?
I'm doing Fritz Von Erich singing the songs of 1983.
Oh.
But he's not singing. Fritz can't sing. Bring me my denim and then bring me the pizza that Mike was going to bring from Pizza Inn.
I thought you were doing the Black Scorpion.
No. You see, Fritz is a little more gruff, and it's a little harder with headphones than without headphones. Let me tell you something, Michael Hayes. Black Scorpion's more Bix. Bix. Ole is a Scandinavian name. And fuck you. You play that stupid idiot thing, I'm going to slap you again.
You stupid idiot!
I'm going to fucking knock you out. And then the easiest one on my voice is easily Sue the Shooter. Like, that puts no pressure at all on my voice.
I love the Von Erich. I wish there was a wee witty Von Erich. He could put the iron claw on my uterus.
That's easy.
That
I could do
make any sense whatsoever.
I could do Sue the Shooter all day. Well, I shouldn't say that. That's a deadly statement. But that's the easiest one on my voice. But
okay, I'm going to take a note to make a drop of that.
Yeah, you're not playing that on the show. Number six, El Pibe Diaz, 83. Still there. See, that makes me think people are listening to the early shows.
Where was he last week?
Last week, El Pibe was number seven, so he moved up one spot.
They may have also seen Botchamania or the video, or our video, if they haven't listened back. Excuse me.
Number five, the Black Scorpion.
Fuck you, Bix.
Bix hates the Black Scorpion. For those of you who haven't gotten it yet on the show, the listeners all love the Black Scorpion. Bix hates the Black Scorpion. That's why whenever I do it, he tenses up and he doesn't play along. He just hates the Black Scorpion.
Well, the listeners didn't like him early on either.
Yeah, when we had less listeners than we do now, now they overwhelmingly like the Black Scorpion and they overwhelmingly like Denim Fritz Von Erich, and you're in a corner by yourself. Black Scorpion lives, baby.
Well, I don't do characters like you.
But the Black Scorpion.
I'm not like you and Mr. Imus. I don't do characters.
The Black Scorpion lost in his tiebreaker runoff to number four, Sue the Shooter, who was also number four last week. So she's holding steady at number four.
I'll take him four at a time.
Number three, Mark Uleen moves up from number six to number three. What do you think of that, Bix?
You will see him in the coming week.
See who?
Your Mamba, the jungle savage.
I thought you would have said totally awesome when I said, what do you think of that? And you went with...
I had a total brain fart. I don't know why I didn't go with totally awesome.
Number two. This one is almost there. It was at number three last week. Number two, Santo Gold.
Totally awesome.
Oh, it's totally awesome. He's got the gold, baby. If Jeff Jarrett keeps this shit up, Santo Gold may be number one pretty soon.
Is Jeff Jarrett now a member of the Super Universe?
No, he's not.
He doesn't deserve it.
He doesn't deserve it. You got to earn it. You got to earn this, baby. Number one of the top 10, who's going to be going for the title next week, Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage. See, now is the time to play the Yo Mamba audio.
See, no, because there's no, because you said Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage. Never mind.
You should have played it, and then I would have said it a second time. Which we've done on the show before.
So it would be like Santo Gold then.
Yeah, maybe.
Except it would be
Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
In the championship match, it was the Slip House Boys over Orgasmic Larry Nelson. So Larry Nelson's eligible again next week for the top 10. And next week it's the Slip House Boys versus Yo Mamba for the 605 Super Universe Championship. The top 10 voting will be starting at around 4 o'clock on Thursday on the Facebook.com/Super Podcast page. And you will have the list of all the eligible candidates on there. This week, we're adding two more names to the list of people you can vote for. Robbie V and the Kayfabe Cops.
You mean Robbie 5?
Robbie 5. I fucked that up. Robbie 5 and... I'm reading my notes the way it's supposed to be, as opposed to the way the idiot said it years ago on the wrestling.
Spell it phonetically.
And the Kayfabe Cops. So you can vote for everyone this week on Facebook.com/Super Podcast. It should be up Thursday afternoon. Voting will go from Thursday to Monday. And if there are any ties at that time, there will be a runoff from Monday to Tuesday, just like we did this week and last week. And we do every week here on the show. I believe next we have... we're going to do Dennis of the Week next. We'll do Dennis of the Week.
Yes.
So
for Dennis of the Week,
we got a couple interesting things here. We talked with John McAdam this week. Now, a lot of you probably know who John is. A lot of you may not. John was one of the premier tape traders of the late 80s and into the 90s. He had a really great collection of tapes. He had a great catalog. His catalog was extraordinary. And I'm going to ask him if I could put up a couple pages on the Facebook page so people could see. He would not only list things that were in there, but he would leave comments, tell stories. It was really the best of the tape catalogs out there.
By far.
By far. Best tape list out there. So we talked with John a little bit about Dennis Caraluzzo, because John was friends with Dennis, and John was involved. Well, John was around Dennis in Memphis for the story he's about to say. But let me just say a few things. As we're telling this story, there was another story that popped into my head that Bix and I had recently heard that we had to ask John about, which you'll hear here. It's about Kevin Von Erich getting a phone call from Jamie Dundee. So we discussed that here, and when we come out of this, we'll tell you a little bit more. So now here's the Dennis of the Week with John McAdam. John, how did you first meet Dennis, and what were your first impressions of him?
Okay, the first time I ever spoke with Dennis, and I went on my very first kind of real wrestling trip to Philadelphia, I want to say September 87, and I met up with Tom Robinson and Jamie Ward for the first time. And I was on the phone with Dennis, and we were talking about like another mutual friend of ours. He's like, look, man, I love the fucking guy, but he's a fucking retard. Don't bring him around because shit will go wrong, okay? So right away, I'm like, wow, this guy's pretty crazy. And I met him later that weekend. Tom introduced me to him. We actually went to one of his shows, and I don't remember a lot about it, but Dennis was very impressed with coming up with a manager with a gimmick named the Swami from Miami. Dennis was in love with this. But because he was promoting, and, you know, he had a lot going on, so I didn't see a lot of him that weekend. But I definitely came home with, like, you know, wow, I'm in a character this time.
And so after you meet him the first time, do you stay in touch with Dennis?
Not directly with Dennis, but, you know, Tom and I were really good friends. And the next summer, I went down to Philadelphia. And I actually spent maybe about 5 days down there, and Tom was nice enough to let me stay with him. And that's when Dennis and I kind of got to know each other a lot better. I think we went out to dinner or something. But the real bonding took place October 88 when we all went to the UAWF convention in Memphis.
Right, the UAWF convention in Memphis. I know that's kind of like a big gathering of the inside smart fans of the era. Dave Meltzer, Ron Lemieux, of course, Tom Burke, Jamie Ward, Tom Robinson, Paulie Dangerously, Eddie Gilbert, Missy Hyatt. A lot, big crowd there. What was the scene like at that convention?
Well, at first, everyone was kind of a little bit nervous. No one really knew each other except for me and the Philly guys. Let me see. Randy Smith was there as well. One thing about Randy, Randy was like the guy who – he was kind of popular but not the most popular kid in school. But his parents were gone a lot, and he had a lot of parties at his house. So you grew to like him because all the crazy stuff went on in Randy's hotel room. So that's why I remember Randy.
And was that the first time you met Dave Meltzer?
Yes, it was. Dave and I had been on the phone a few times, and he and I hit it off really well. And, that was the first time I met him in person. And he and I, after this thing, like when we got together, he and I would room a lot together. And I get pissed when people are like, you know, oh, Dave, he doesn't know everything. I don't like Dave. Dave is the nicest guy in the world. And he is so patient because I think you've seen this. When people see Dave, it's like the Messiah has arrived.
Yeah.
And people go out of their minds with questions. And, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm meeting you. And he's got that whole laid-back California cool thing going on. Like, I would snap, you know?
Well, you know, you're talking to him on the phone. You're reading The Observer at that time. What's your impression the first time you meet him and you realize here's a bodybuilder, not some, you know, just an average fan like everyone else?
That was exactly my impression. I'm like, okay, I'm a head taller than this guy, but look at him. He's in phenomenal shape.
Well, getting back to Dennis, are there any funny stories you could remember from that 1988 trip to the UAWF convention in Memphis?
There is. There's one in particular that stands out. We went to the tapings at the WMC's Channel 5 studio, which I'm glad I got to do once. And afterward, we kind of got all split up. I actually wound up going to Poe Folks with J.D. McKay, and the Philly guys got in a cab, and they went someplace. And these guys are talking shop, and the cab driver goes, hey, you guys wrestling fans? Because I used to be in the business. And these guys are like, yeah, right. And they're like, oh, who'd you work at? Nate the Rat. And these guys are like, holy shit, it's him. It's Nate the Rat driving a cab. And so Dennis is, you know, goes ballistic, takes this guy under his wing, invites him over to the hotel after his shift is over. And we wind up, you know, hanging out, taking pictures, swapping stories. He was a good guy. And we wind up going out to dinner. Now, it's me, Dennis, Jamie Ward, Randy Smith, Frank Chili, and Nate, and if I'm forgetting anyone, I apologize. And, you know, we're young guys. I mean, we're not quiet when we go out. I'm pretty sure the guys from Saturday Night Fever who went to White Castle complained that we were too loud. But, you know, like, we were just being dudes. And we're in this – it's a family restaurant. People are out with their kids. And all of a sudden, Dennis stands up. Hey, can I have everyone's attention, please? To the whole goddamn restaurant. Is, I want everyone to raise their glass to one of the greatest pro wrestling managers of all time, Nate the Rat. Come on, everybody. Let's hear it for Nate. Everyone's like, you know, clapping and you know, raising their glasses to Nate. So that's my Dennis of the week.
I think the story goes that Dennis was in a cab, and I believe Jamie Ward was in the cab. And when they realized Nate was the driver, Dennis yells out, Nate the Rat! Nate the fucking Rat! He was just so excited and overjoyed that it was Nate the Rat.
No, so, as far as I know, my version of the story is correct. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm in the business. And these guys are like, yeah, right. But, yeah, Dennis got – and you know, he was Nate the fucking Rat the way you're Brian Last. I mean, it was just – that was his name from now on. And Dennis loved the guy. He would fly him in from Memphis to New Jersey to manage.
That's amazing. I remember hearing stories from Dennis that he would fly Nate in, and I believe Nate stayed at his house, and they would wake up and find Nate sitting on the floor playing with Mark Carluzzo's toys. And that's the story I remember hearing at the time. And, you know, Nate was, yeah, I don't know, would you call him the jobber manager, or what exactly would you call his role in Memphis at that time?
At that time, he was definitely the jobber manager. They brought him in and out. He would manage guys like Rough and Ready.
Yeah, and he was driving a cab with Keith Eric, from what Jamie Ward told us. So there you go.
I did not know Keith was driving a cab, but he actually came over and was part of the convention too.
You know, on the topic of this UAWF convention in 1988 in Memphis, one of the legendary stories that I've only heard a little bit of and Bix has only heard a little bit of that we would love to hear is a famous phone call to Kevin Von Erich from Jamie Dundee. Can you fill in the blanks of the story?
I will do my best, gentlemen. Let me preface this by saying I should not have done it. And Kevin, if you are listening to this, I owe you an apology. Tom Robinson and I went around Memphis trying to find the Von Erichs, because back then our sport of choice was getting our pictures taken with pro wrestlers, and we did not have pictures with the Von Erichs. And we couldn't find them. Like, we, you know, we're going, calling hotels the whole nine yards, and we finally find out where they are, but they're out, and we can't get our stupid pictures. And the joke going around, which really wasn't a joke, is we better get these pictures before these guys die. And so Tom and I show up at the hotel, I want to say like 10, 11 o'clock, and these guys are just chilling out watching videotapes. And with, you know, no alcohol, no drugs, but Tom and I knew how to party, and we got the party started. You know, we were joking around, being loud, goofing around with everybody. And, you know, we get kicked out of the wherever it is in the hotel, you know, just like the big room where you get to hang out. We go to Randy Smith's room. And someone comes up with the idea of, let's call Kevin Von Erich. It wasn't me, but I'm like, no, I'll do it. So I'm like, all right, don't anyone laugh. Bite your hand off before you laugh. You're going to ruin my call. So, oh, and Jamie Dundee, I forget why, but everyone was annoyed with the guy. He was the 17-year-old baby face that couldn't do anything. And we all hated him. So I call up the hotel. I'm like, yeah, can you connect me to Kevin Von Erich's room? The guy's like, you know, he knew who I was at this point. He's like, yeah, sure. So the phone rings, and it's Kevin Von Erich. I'm like, Hey, Kevin, this is Jamie Dundee, brother. How you doing? And of course, everyone in the room laughs. I'm like, knock it off. And I had poor Kevin on the phone for an hour, trying to coax him to, like, leave the hotel room. I told him I had a couple of girls with me. One was a big Kevin fan. She wants him to carve his initials onto her back. He wasn't going for it.
What?
And finally, the phone call ends. I mean, we talked about everything. I'm like, you know, where's the best place in wrestling to get laid? He says Hawaii. Trying to think
that
of
explains
else.
A lot. Like,
didn't he just move to Hawaii, Bix?
Yes, that's my point. When he sold the tape library.
I did not add those two things together. Wow.
When he sold the tape library to WWE, he used that and his inheritance from Fritz to move his whole family to Hawaii.
Mystery solved. I did not add those two things together. Jeez. So I figure, okay, I've got to go out in a blaze of glory here. And as Jamie, I'm like, oh, yeah, and the whole reason I'm calling is because whoever was running USWA at the time, what time's your flight, Kevin? He's like, oh, man, it's like 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, yeah, the flight's been moved to 1 p.m. And Kevin's like, oh, that's great. Thanks. Oh, fantastic. So who was it that had to drag Kevin out of his room to get him on the plane on time? Frank Dusick. So luckily at all, Kevin did not miss his flight, and we got a little bit of a pranking on him. And like I said, shouldn't have done it, but that's what happened.
Well, that's pretty – who was
if I may add to this?
Yeah, please.
About not even 10 years later, I get a call from someone asking for like old world-class stuff that Kevin Von Erich didn't have. He was calling me for this when I was living in Drake at Mass, and we got along just great. And like two or three times after that, my phone would ring and it'd be Kevin Von Erich just calling to shoot the shit.
What kind of guy was he?
You know what, Kevin, he was a really good guy and he was smart. And if anyone out there is saying, no, he wasn't, well, did you talk to him on the phone for about an hour at a time, three times? I told him, you know, oh yeah, I made it a point to go out to the show you guys had out here in Lynn. I forget the name of the place. He goes, oh, the Manning Bowl.
Wow.
Like, think of all the places he's been, and he just knew that right off the top of his head. So good guy, good conversationalist. You know, he was open about this business. I don't have a bad word to say about Kevin.
When you play at the Manning Bowl, do you win the David Manning Cup?
You know, you get a trip to probably the worst city in Massachusetts.
No, when you play the Manning Bowl, the gate mysteriously gets stolen after every show.
No, that's the Far Hat Bowl, sir.
Well, let me ask you this, John. After 1988 in Memphis, when is the next time you see Dennis, and do you keep up with him? Do you continue the relationship after that convention?
I did. Let me see. I definitely saw him in Philadelphia. We actually had an impromptu convention a few months later. And anytime I went down to Philly to see a show or to hang out with Tom or whatever, I mean, I always ran into Dennis. Scott Dickinson used to referee Dennis's shows, and sometimes we would go down and see Dennis. And, you know, someone once – a couple of people told me, like, after he died, it was like, oh, man, he loved you. And I'm like, oh, I wish I kept up with him more.
In closing, like, what are your lasting thoughts and memories about Dennis? And, you know, in your mind, you know, what kind of guy was he?
Dennis was a good guy with a good heart who was a lot of fun to be around. If I had to list the craziest characters that I've ever met in my life, and I'm 50 years old, Dennis would be number two. That's how insane Dennis was. But he was always fun to be around. Couldn't keep a straight face around the guy. He was always having fun, you know, unless he was in the middle of a promotional war with Paulie or whatever. And, yeah, I miss him, and I wish I had done more to maintain my relationship with him, like, you know, as the 90s wore on.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the promotional war with Paulie, because I think to the average wrestling fan, they would think that here are two guys that really didn't know each other at all. And, you know, Paulie's on one side and Dennis is on the other. And there are all sorts of issues in between them. When in reality, they knew each other for years. And like I said before, both of them were at that UAWF convention in 88. And I know Paul ran into Dennis when NWA was running Philadelphia. They actually had a relationship and knew each other before everything went down in 1994 with ECW.
I don't think they liked each other, though.
That seems to be the consensus, yeah.
I specifically remember in Memphis, we were like eating at a big buffet, and Dennis, like Paul was talking about something, and Dennis cut him off to talk about like some Abdullah the Butcher versus Johnny Rod story that when he was promoting. And Paulie is behind him, and he picks up this giant carving knife and starts emulating stabbing Dennis repeatedly in the back.
What?
And I have to sit here with a straight face while this is going on. And Dennis is like, yo, man, you should have seen Johnny Rod. And Paulie's doing this, and it's like, oh, my God.
Oh, too bad Nate the Rat wasn't there to save the day. Well, that was funny. It is nice that John apologized for doing it, but what a funny story of John calling Kevin Von Erich as Jamie Dundee. Pretty good Jamie Dundee impression there, Vix.
Honestly, I was not that impressed by Jamie Dundee.
Well, again, it's not Jamie Dundee in the 90s or now. It was like young teenage Jamie Dundee.
True.
I thought it was pretty good.
True, this isn't Jamie Dundee as we think of Jamie Dundee now.
Right. This is, you know, the most humble version possible of Jamie Dundee, which wasn't humble at all. You know, it's just a young Jamie Dundee. But that was really good. I want to say there's going to be more from John McAdam. We'll tell you about shortly. Later on in this program, we're going to have a lot more with John that I think everyone's going to really like. But before we go any further, and I got a story about a phony phone call I made involved in professional wrestling. But John talked about Nate the Rat. Nate the fucking Rat. And he talked about Dennis's involvement with him. Bix and I last week spoke with Jamie Ward, who is a contemporary of John's, another elite fan of the late 80s, a tape trader and newsletter writer, really, really cool guy. And Jamie had a few thoughts and a few remembrances of Dennis's involvement with Nate the Rat. So I think now's a good time to play a couple minutes of that so you can hear another side of Dennis's involvement with Nate the fucking Rat. Jamie, what's the famous story of Dennis meeting Nate the Rat?
Nate the effing Rat, as Dennis would say. We're at the UAWF convention, Memphis, 1988. I want to say that we're coming back from the TV studio back to the hotel, and Dennis is in the front seat, and in the back was myself sitting behind Dennis, and then Frankie the Thumper, I believe, was there, and he was sitting behind the cab driver, and this guy's talking, and you know, him and Dennis are kibitzing back and forth. And I tapped Dennis on the shoulder and I said to Dennis, you know who that is? And Dennis says, no, who is it? I said, that's Nate the Rat, the former manager. He goes, get out of here. Hey, buddy, are you Nate the Rat? He goes, yeah, I used to be a manager here. And the rest is just like history. We get back to the hotel and he tells Nate, oh, man, they misused you down here. And I'm going to bring you up to New Jersey. I'm going to make a legend out of you. And so we get back to the hotel and I have pictures of us with Nate the Rat right after the ride. And then he comes back later in the evening because we were having something and he brings Keith Erich with him. Keith Erich was a cab driver also. So we got pictures of with Nate and Keith Erich. And then the next night is like the big ceremony of the weekend. And here comes Dennis talks Nate into showing up in full costume. And Nate shows up. Including Paulie Dangerously at the time making fun of Nate about never having a career to begin with. And here Dennis, you know, after that, he was true to his word. He flew Nate up a couple times to his shows in Jersey and Nate got good heat, believe it or not.
Bix, what's the chances we can find Nate the Rat and get him on the show? What was his name? Nate Whitlock?
Yes. I mean, I think that's his real name, too. I mean, it was the name he used on TV when he wasn't just Nate the Rat, but I think that's his real name. Yeah.
We may have to get him to find out his version of things from hanging out around Dennis. I will say, and I'm going to ask Jamie and John if we can put this up, but they sent Jamie sent me a picture of Dennis, Frank Chili, who you've heard referenced on various Dennis's of the Week, Jamie and John with Nate the Rat, and they're all doing the Four Horsemen sign, and Nate's in his full gimmick, just standing there in the middle of them, like the proud manager. And it's pretty funny. It's pretty funny seeing Nate with them in that setting. We're gonna have more with John McAdam shortly, because we planned to do the Dennis of the Week. We wanted to get the Kevin Von Erich phone call story. And then we just ended up having a long, fun discussion with John about a whole number of things, from the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame to the old days of tape trading. And I know you guys have heard me and Bix talk about that we're building up an interview catalog right now with old fans, fans from the 80s, smart fans, the first generation of smart fans and tape traders, to find out their story about being around wrestling, because we think it's a lost history. And we wanted to talk to John to do that. We had talked to Jamie about that. We had talked to a few other people. And we had such a good time talking with John, and the conversation ended up going in so many different ways that I think we're just going to play that on the show, because I think everyone's really, really going to like it. And before we get there, though, Bix, I referenced before with the Kevin Von Erich phone call story that I was involved in a wrestling phony phone call, or two, maybe, at one point in my life. So let me tell this story. It was an ECW show in either 96, I would guess it was either the summer of 96 or early 97, probably 96. And I was staying at the Travelodge. That was the ECW, the hotel everyone was at. I got a room, and Devin Storm, who I was friends with, stayed in my room because, you know, they weren't being paid a lot of money. And I certainly said, like, look, I have two beds. You can, that's fine. You can stay in the bed.
And he's a legitimately nice guy.
Oh, he's a great guy. I met him. I can't believe he was nice to me, because the first time I saw him was at the NWA tournament on November 19th, 1994, and he did an Asai moonsault right onto his head. And I immediately – and Tim Knoll, a friend of ours, filmed that, sent me the tape, and I immediately cut the 5 seconds of him landing on his head, and I put that on every single tape party tape I ever had.
Oh, boy.
Like, everyone saw that thing. And in fact, at one point at one of Dennis's conventions, he had like a banquet, and it was a Q&A with like Dory Funk Jr. and Jim Cornette and a few other people. And Devin and Ace Darling were standing in the door, and someone asked, when are you going to start using some of Dennis's guys on the WWF shows? And he goes, well, you know, I'm doing my best to try to help these guys out. And he goes, I haven't seen as much as I'd like of Ace and Devin. The only thing I ever see of Devin is that tape Brian Last shows everyone, him landed on his head. And he just, he turns to me and he looks so sad. He goes, thanks, Brian. And you know, I felt bad for the guy, but really, really nice guy. Really, really nice guy. One of the best matches I ever saw live, Devin Storm against Sabu, November of 95, I believe. Really, really cool guy. So he stayed with me. I knew him for a few years. And like I did for any wrestling trip I made, I brought a VCR. Back then, you could just unplug the TV and hook your VCR up to it. Now they have everything wired, so you can't do anything. Plus, who's carrying around a VCR in 2016? So I set up my VCR, bring down some of my best tape party tapes, and we're going to have a tape party in my room. And the Blue Meanie came. A bunch of the guys who were involved with the Pro Wrestling Lariat newsletter. Dave Shearer, Jess McGrath, a few other people. Not sure who. There are a couple other workers, and I don't remember who. But we're all in there just having a good time, eating, watching wrestling. It's amazing, like, even people who drink, when there's, like, wrestling on, usually they'll stop drinking and just hang out and watch the wrestling and talk to everyone. It's funny how that happens. And at some point, we thought we were talking about one of the ring rats who was a fairly regular at ECW shows. Her name – the name she was called was Crack Baby. Yeah, I'm not trying to disparage her, but that's just – that's the name I knew her as. That's the name every single person called her, from the wrestlers who allegedly did things to her with a telephone to the – average fan who ran into her. Her name was Crack Baby.
Hmm.
And if you watch ECW, you'll see her on various things. And once someone points out her name was Crack Baby, you'll never be able to, like, unsee or forget that that's her name. So we figured out what room she was in. And it was like, it was kind of like the John McAdam thing he was talking about. Everyone was like, someone should call her, someone should call her. Who's going to call her? You do it last. And I'm always up for a challenge. So I'm trying to think what I should do. And someone said, you should call her as Rob Van Dam. Now, Rob Van Dam hadn't been doing many interviews at this time. He really wasn't known for promos. The little bit of interviews we have seen of him, He seemed to have a high-pitched voice. And I got to say, it seemed much higher pitched than it actually was. Because once he started doing promos, you realize it wasn't that exaggerated.
But
yeah?
I accidentally muted myself.
You muted so in the middle of a... I heard, butta.
Let's leave that in. I have no idea how I even did that.
Black magic. What were you going to say, though, Vince?
I was going to say that I remember thinking the same thing, that he had a fairly high voice at the time, even though he didn't.
So, I call Crack Baby with my Rob Van Dam voice, which sounds almost like an Americanized Sue the Shooter, I guess. I was like, I forget what her name was. I should just give her a name. Let's call her Wendy. I said, hi, Wendy. Hey, it's Rob Van Dam. How's it going? And she totally bought it right away. And she's like, hey, Rob, how you doing? You want a party? I was like, of course I want a party. I always want a party. Come downstairs and dance with me. And we end up having this 5-minute discussion of me trying to get her to come downstairs and dance, and she won't do it.
This is horrifying.
And finally she goes, and the rest of the room is holding it in because I don't even remember everything I was saying, but everyone was like laughing and somehow she didn't hear it. And she finally goes, who are you dancing with? And I said, I'm dancing with New Jack. And then, like, everyone busted out laughing, and no one could contain it anymore. Because the idea of Rob Van Dam dancing with New Jack downstairs. I like New Jack. He was always nice to me. If he had heard that, he probably would have stabbed me and thrown me out the fucking window. And she was like, oh, I don't know, Rob. I'm waiting for Sabu to call or someone. Maybe it wasn't Sabu, but she was waiting on some wrestler. And I was trying to replace that wrestler with my phony Rob Van Dam. And finally, I just hung up and I told her, I was like, you know what? Forget it. You're just a dumb bitch, Crack Baby. Don't ever talk to me again. And I hung up. And the next day at the arena, she like wouldn't even make eye contact with Rob Van Dam. It was really, really funny. And then another phone call, there was some fan. I forget what his name was. I want to say his name was Steve. And someone said we should call Steve. And Devin Storm decided to do it. And Devin had a really bad stutter. Like a really, really, really bad stutter.
Really? I did not know that about him.
Yeah, somehow it didn't come out when he did wrestling stuff, but he had a really, really bad stutter. And it didn't come out on his phony phone call, but he's like threatening this guy, like, you know, and again, imagine just you're in a hotel room, you get a phone call just out of nowhere, someone's saying that they're gonna kick the shit out of you and, you know, beat you up. And Devin's like, I'm gonna fuck you up. I'm gonna kick your ass. I'm gonna take you by the hair and wipe your ass with my face. And when he said that, yeah, he was trying to say the opposite, and he said it the wrong way. And as soon as he said that, he just like he looked at the phone. He couldn't believe he just said that, and everyone's dying. And then Blue Meanie's like, tell him you're going to grab him and kick your ass. And he goes, I'm going to grab you and kick my ass. You know, then he started playing with it. But that's the line I remember. I'm going to take you by the hair and wipe your ass with my face. That weekend also, I got edited off ECW TV, Bix. Did I ever tell you this story?
No. I can recall.
Everyone around ECW at that time, like Dave Shearer, the Lariat guys, the regular fans, they all hated Bubba Ray Dudley because he was like a complete dick to everyone. And he was at this point like a super baby face. You know, he wasn't doing the stuttering anymore, I don't think. And he wasn't doing the dancing. But he was still Paulie. He was trying to get him over as his major baby face. And he had been a dick to a bunch of people. I think he had done something, a sign guy. And all the regulars there hated Bubba Ray Dudley.
This is shocking.
And, well, this is 96, too. Think about how early this is. He had been there less than a year, I think. And everyone's like, we got to do something about it. We got to do something. They couldn't think of anything to do. So I figured out something to do. And I went to the hotel. There actually was like a little store in the hotel. I bought the only markers they had were these giant red markers. And I went upstairs and I took the sheet off my bed. And I made the biggest sign possible that said, Bubba must die. And Bubba was really big, and then must die underneath it. And Devin Storm woke up and he saw me doing that. He's like, don't tell anyone I roomed with you. Don't tell anyone I was here. You're going to get a lot of heat. I said, that's fine. So I bring it to the ECW show. And again, they're pushing Bubba down everyone's throat as a baby face. And when he comes out, I take out this giant sheet. And me and several other people, I think Jess McGrath might have been one of them, a few other people, hold up this sign. It's bigger than any sign in the history of ECW. Because it was you. It was a bed sheet. It was like a queen-size bed sheet. It was massive. And the markers somehow looked awesome. It looked really good. Apparently, Paulie flipped out. And that is the tightest shot you will ever see on ECW TV. You can't even see the word Bubba. All you see is like Ust die. Like he cut it so tight so that sign wouldn't be on TV. And shortly after that, he gave up on making Bubba a babyface and turned him heel. So I think I may have had a part to do in that. And that's when I ended up getting edited off ECW TV.
So you're saying you're responsible for Bubba finding himself as a heel?
Yeah. I'm saying I take full credit for that. It's a Long Island thing. I take full credit for that. Someone has to find that, though. There's a, again, I think it's probably the summer of 96, maybe the spring of 96. Could be after that, but it would be the Dudleys in the ring, and it would be a giant sign on a white sheet with red marker that said, Bubba must die, and immediately they go to a tight shot so you could barely see it.
And this is an arena show that Devin Storm would have been on. But it's an ECW arena taping.
Yes, Devin Storm was definitely there. Blue Meanie was definitely there because they were in my room that I remember.
Okay.
So if anyone could find this and do a screenshot, I would love to see that. But anyway, that's my phony phone call and my and my story about getting edited off ECW TV. Before we move forward with John McAdam, Biggs, let's talk about commercials.
Yes, we teased this last week. We took requests, and I think we have a few we want to spotlight. We're not going to do too many. I think we're going to try to make this an ongoing thing. I mean, I guess we'll see what the listeners think, but I guess that's the idea, right?
Yeah, so this will be like an ongoing thing, the same way the steroids and wrestling topic, Vix, will be an ongoing thing. The steroids and wrestling topic obviously started when Vix was in second grade, and he interrogated an NFL player, as many of you know here on the show. What was the name of the player again?
Mark Boyer.
Mark Boyer. Bix does not apologize at all, Mark. You gotta learn to take this kind of heat from the press, even if they're in second grade. You know, one of our listeners, Warren Hulander, actually sent me a quick little story I'll read here, Bix, about steroids and wrestling. He was doing security. He was like, I guess maybe he's like an indie worker. He was doing a security spot on SmackDown in Atlanta in 2004 or so. And when Kurt Angle had Nathan Jones and Matt Morgan in his stable, which I don't even remember. I guess I was tuned down at that time. And he said, those two were standing around when Arn Anderson walks in and looks at both of them and says, there is enough gas in this room to launch the fucking space shuttle. So that's a pretty good line right there.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's this week's edition of Steroids and Wrestling. Thank you, Warren, a really nice listener of 605, the Super Podcast. He sent that, by the way, to facebook.com/superpodcast. Like everyone else should communicate with us. It's a fun little community. But it's time for commercials, Bix. You feeling very commercial?
I'm feeling somewhat non-commercial. I don't want to sell out, but I guess I have to go commercial.
You have to go commercial. You can't be the indie darling forever. So what do we got first on the docket?
All right, let's see. Well, this kind of came out of us listening to the Von Erich brothers doing a commercial for Pizza Inn. And there happens to be a second Von Erich commercial for Pizza Inn.
And it isn't like shot on the same day or anything, because they're in different outfits and it just seems like it's a completely different shoot. So they had multiple days of shooting Pizza Inn commercials.
They could have just changed their clothes.
Maybe.
I'd like to see them change their clothes.
What?
I want a pizza with denim Fritz.
I could do Sue the Shooter all day. You already hit me with that. You. Oh, I'm trying not to yell too loud. The kids are still awake. I'm gonna. I don't want them to hear me call you all sorts of names that I don't want to. Motherfucker.
Well, the first Von Erich's Pizza Inn commercial, we were actually surprised by how good they were in it.
Yeah.
They actually did a very solid job as pitchmen. So let's
Before we play this, yeah. I want to say an observation I had actually thinking about it after the fact was, you know, Mike Von Erich, we just had the anniversary of his unfortunate suicide, and he was only 23 years old when that happened in 87. So this commercial, I want to say this was probably when he was 20 or 21, right? 84, 85. Couldn't have been 86.
Right.
And you know, he gets ripped a lot, that he wasn't good, that he didn't deserve his spot, that he was pushed to the top too quick. And you watch his commercial, and I got to say, he really does show like this genuine, nice guy. Like, I don't know if charisma is the right word, but he shows more like ability in front of the camera here than I think I've ever seen before.
he comes off as a fun guy to be around.
Yeah, he comes across like a real fun guy to be around. And, you know, you don't look at him and just like, oh, there's Mike. It's like Kevin, Carey, and Mike. No, it's like it's the three Von Erich brothers, and they're all equally good in the commercial.
Yeah. So let's take a look at this one first.
We're here to show you the ropes at Pizza Inn. When it comes to original thin crust pizza, nothing can beat it except cheesy pan pizza. Come on, you guys, call it a draw. With the all-you-can-eat buffet, you can always go back for more. All the pizza, salad, and muffins you can handle, made with the freshest ingredients for a super low price. I just got a new Pizza Inn phone for $14.95. Well, I want one of those too. Give me that. Hello? It's for you, Kevin. Hello.
Pizza, salad, and muffins?
Yeah, I was going to say, wait, is this a chain in Texas or somewhere else? Or
I think it's a chain in Texas.
They give you pizza, salad, and muffins.
As they show a blueberry muffin being torn apart on the
sounds like a lot of carbs with that salad. Just
but I would even say after watching this, I would say that Mike is actually the one giving the best performance in that ad.
Yeah. Mike's the one that seems the most into it, and he's actually really good in front of the camera.
I would say Mike, then Carey, then Kevin.
You know, there's been this myth through the years that Mike was forced into wrestling, that Fritz wanted all of his sons to be NWA champions and pushed Mike into it, and he didn't want to. I think that's now kind of being debunked, that Mike actually loved being a Von Erich, and he loved being a wrestling Von Erich, wouldn't you say?
Chris even more so.
Oh, well, I mean, when it got to Chris, he wanted it more than maybe all of them. Because his whole life was watching his older brothers be the biggest stars in North Texas.
Right. My point being, though, that the ones we look at as being, oh, sad, forced into it. No, Chris. I mean, I would say Chris more than Mike. Because
they were guys
who had like this artistic temperament, too. So it's.
I've never heard that about Chris, though, that he was pushed into it.
No, that's what I'm saying, that some people act like it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no. I mean, they wanted to be Von Erichs just like their brothers.
And they got to be Von Erichs, and I mean, what happened sucks. But you know, with Chris, Chris, it was just unfortunate. He probably, like you said, he probably wanted it more than any of his brothers. It just his body didn't cooperate.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, again, go back to these commercials and look at them. They'll be in our video playlist. Mike Von Erich looks full of life and very happy here, and it's nice to see that.
And he got dealt a bad hand, and for whatever you want to say about suicide and what happens in families and how it makes people more likely, if well, although he was the first, and he had brain damage. I mean, he just had a bad set of stuff happen to him.
Yeah, the toxic shock syndrome really set everything into play, and it's very important for people to understand that. He had a temperature so high for so long that it affected his brain. We're not saying – Bix isn't saying he's brain damaged to make fun of him or anything.
No.
He literally suffered damage due to his fever that he had for such a long period of time. And you know, anything you see with him from the hospital press conference to him returning at the Cotton Bowl in a car, you feel bad for the guy. You feel really bad for the guy. And again, you know, he was the very first one to – you know, unfortunately commit suicide, and definitely that toxic shock syndrome and the damage it caused were you got to believe that was a major part of that.
And he had a medical instrument left in him after his shoulder surgery is what happened, I believe.
Is that what it was?
That's what I've read. Something like that. So he was dealt a bad hand.
Man.
So on a lighter note, I did look up Pizza Inn on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
First of all, they are on the NASDAQ. They are a public company.
How many muffins is the stock at right now?
Let's see.
Muffins and pizza.
Rave Restaurant Group.
Oh.
Is trading right now at $5.25 a share, up 22 cents or 4.37%.
From yesterday?
I guess so.
And does it have a dividend?
I have no idea.
Yield. Does it have a yield?
Does it say that?
It should say there. It should say if it has a yield or not.
Let's see. I can't believe you're making me look in.
Forget it. I'll look it up because if it's. I play the market. It's one of my things. Okay, what's the next commercial, Biggs?
I was going to actually read more about Pizza.
Oh, there's more.
They have a very strange logo, by the way. At least these days. How do I describe it? Go look it up on Wikipedia right now. It is a
it is Super Mario's young son wearing a fake mustache
and a dunce cap.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it almost looks like Chico Marx's hat with a little mustache.
It's the most bootleg possible Super Mario.
I kind of want a T-shirt with this guy now.
Maybe they have T-shirts.
They have to. It's Pizza Inn.
They're based out of Texas, started in 1958. A sister restaurant in Fort Worth known as Pie 5 Pizza that specializes in handcrafted pizzas ready in 5 minutes. Because when I think about handcrafted pizza, I think ready in 5 minutes.
Man.
They operate 310 franchise stores. And five, where are these 12 countries? Maybe not. Maybe the only ones out of Texas are not in the States. Pizza in Kuwait, pizza in Saudi Arabia. Okay, I can't think about this anymore.
Yeah, you took this too far. I can't get past the muffins and the pizza.
I saw the 310 stores that I just wanted to know more.
What did you say the name of the parent company was?
Rave Restaurant Group.
Oh, Rave. Okay, Rave. I thought Rave. It was Rave.
R-A-V-E.
Okay, Rave. That sounds healthy. Rave Restaurant Group.
Free glow sticks with every order.
Yeah.
So our next commercial, there are actually a few of these. Oh, this is the only one I've seen on YouTube. And I used to have the tape of all this. Back in, I think this is 1986. The WWF was setting up a tour of Australia and running TV and a lot of localized promos and stuff. And I guess they were a big enough deal there that they started running Toyota ads for Toyota cars with WWF wrestlers. And this is during the Oh, What a Feeling era, which how would you describe Oh, What a Feeling?
Oh, what a feeling.
Oh, that's what I said to Wee Willie Wilson. I thought I had to go to the bathroom.
I could do Sue the Shooter all day. All right, don't hammer it into the ground, Biggs. I guess this is the campaign after You Got It, Toyota, right?
I guess, but there's the dance or whatever you want to call it at the end, though. How would you describe it? It's like putting your arms up in a Y shape and jumping up and slightly backwards for some reason.
I think you just described it pretty accurately.
Okay. What was it supposed to represent, though? Excitement? Like,
why, as in why are they doing the commercial this way?
Well, so you have this hopeless WWF Australia tour, because if you watch the local promos, it's all...
It wasn't hopeless at all. Moondog Spot was there.
That's true, actually.
It was the same tour. It has to be the same tour, because she saw Moondog Spot and Hercules Hernandez. Oh my God, another clue in the Sue the Shooter story. It unfolds on 6:05.
Iron Sheik wants to take me out in a Toyota.
So it's this tour where the top baby faces, for some reason, are the team of SD Jones and Paul Roma. And this is pre-Young Stallions Paul Roma, so just think about that for a second. And they have these Toyota ads all over the tape. I remember that with all those promos. And the one that is on YouTube has the Iron Sheik. And there are some jokes in here that have to do with the visual, but knowing that it's the Iron Sheik, I think you'll get to them. So here it is with Iron Sheik and Gene Okerlund narrating.
The Toyota Bandera has the go-anywhere toughness and ability of Land Cruiser with the freedom of the wind in your hair. Toyota Bandera, you can't beat.
A lot of feeling.
Unbeatable freedom.
Toyota.
Unbeatable freedom. I mean, they got a Toyota truck in the middle of a wrestling ring, and they decided to put the Iron Sheik in it. He's the guy they wanted this commercial. An Iranian who has trouble with English doing a commercial in Australia. Unbeatable freedom. Is he the only one who says that, or was that like one of their slogans?
I think it's a slogan, but I think they have different wrestlers saying different things in different ads.
I would love it if that was like a Sheik ad lib that made it into the commercial.
that he thought when they were saying, "Oh, what a feeling," that it was actually unbeatable freedom.
Yes, something like that.
I just can't, at this point, I can't see Iron Cheek from this era and not think of the Mickey Sherman video.
Yeah, I know. This is probably a year before that.
No, after. Because if this is from 86.
Is this from 86? Oh, I didn't realize this was 86.
It's either late 85 or sometime in 86, and Cyndi Lauper is in the Mickey Sherman video.
Yeah, this is a year after. That's right. So there's the Iron Cheek for Toyota. You got it, Toyota. Unbeatable freedom.
And it's not the nicest looking truck either.
Hey, it was the 80s. What did you want?
It doesn't reflect well on Australia if that truck is supposed to be from the 80s.
We have a lot of Australian listeners, Bix.
That'd I'm not talking about Australians. I'm talking about Australia.
Hello, Dan Leonard. I know Dan Leonard's listening. He's a huge fan of the show.
I'm not talking about current Australia.
Okay. All right. Well, what's the next commercial before we insult another group of people?
It's Dusty Rhodes doing an ad for Tom Stymus' car dealership somewhere in Florida.
We eventually need to do a tally of the different types of things people had wrestlers advertise. Like how many liquor stores, how many cars or car dealerships. You know what I mean? That's the interesting thing. Who has the most?
How many of the car dealerships are used car dealerships?
Yeah, that's right. This is the second car dealership in a row. Let's play this
one.
Well,
sort of. But
well, yeah.
Close enough.
That's a used car dealer, isn't it?
No, but you said second in a row, and the other one was actually for the car.
Oh, the other one's actually a car. That's a good point.
But it's also the only time that ever happened, so.
Yeah.
I guess it's close enough.
And by the way, before we even play this, this guy in the commercial with Dusty Rhodes, I guess he was like well-known for doing these commercials. When do you hear this guy?
This guy is excitable.
Yeah.
If you shopped at my competition, you'd be talking about $450 a month. Here, $248. Here, $157. Competition, $300. Brand new custom conversion pickup. Tell them, Dream, tell them.
$99.99. Custom conversion pickup right here. Stuyvesant Roads, number one in Florida, number one in your heart, and number one in custom vans, trucks, cars, motorcycles, BB guns, whatever it is, Jack. We're number one in it. Number one!
What was that at the end? Is number one!
You had to get the last word in.
I love the fact they're doing this commercial on a car lot, and there are cars just speeding by in the background. Just flying.
Motorcycles.
Sorry. I forgot to
BB guns! There's a whole series of these Dusty Rhodes and Tom Stymus commercials.
Yeah, there are a bunch of these. Not all of them have Dusty talking for some reason.
I miss, like, fun local commercials. Because we don't get those anymore.
Although, we get a different level of local commercials, at least on cable. Because we both have Verizon Fios, which is weird because they only have, like, they don't have as many like smaller systems as the regular cable companies, so we get ads from like all across the New York area.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's weird. So like I'll be, you know, here on Long Island, and all of a sudden I'm seeing ads from all the way up like in Westchester, Staten Island, or the like that seafood restaurant that has a bunch of ads on for some reason that's in Staten Island or whatever. So those have some charm, I think.
Yeah, I guess so, but not like this. Not like the cheap.
No, nothing like your.
I'm a huge sucker for the film Used Cars, so anything that reminds you of that movie, I'm, like, cool with.
And you are my friend.
And you are my friend. That's where it comes from, for those of you wondering. Now, don't say anything else. Let them go watch the movie. What's next on the commercial docket, Vix?
So this one, I have no idea what year this is from. It looks like it's much later than the prime of either man here. It's Bob Luce.
Oh, boy.
And Yukon Moose Cholak. So do you want to explain who Bob Luce is?
I feel like you do better. You start it off. Because I'm going to be laughing.
He was the promoter in Chicago who promoted shows that were like half AWA, half Bruisers WWA. And his TV show was like film clips from the house shows at the International Amphitheater in Chicago. And he'd do promos in studio,
There's one on YouTube that I put up years ago, which has Gentleman Saul Weingroff attacking a midget.
Fantastic.
I was hoping I'd get a reaction for that, but I guess not.
What was his name? Did I know him?
I don't think it was Wee Willie Wilson.
Okay. I haven't actually seen any footage of Wee Willie Wilson. I've never actually seen him wrestle. I have a few pictures I've seen.
That photo is enough.
That photo tells the story. Well, like Bick said, this is clearly not Mukan. Yukon Moose Cholak's prime.
Mukan Youth Cholak.
I mean, I want to guess this ad is from the 80s.
I would guess maybe even like late 80s when Bob Luce is doing the classic wrestling show.
Oh, it could be that. That's actually timing-wise may work out. But here's Yukon Moose Cholak with the excitable Bob Luce.
And keep in mind that Moose Cholak was at his peak as a star in the early 60s, maybe?
Yeah.
And this appears to be sometime in the late 80s, so here we go.
I'm Bob Luce, here with a member of Pro Wrestling's Hall of Fame, Yukon Moose Cholak. Moose and I are longtime pals and longtime fans of Al's number one Chicago's Italian Beef. You could say we're all Chicago legends in our own time.
I got a lot to be thankful for, Bob. What I need now is an extra hand to eat Al's Italian Beef sandwiches. Two are never enough.
Moose, you're just too much, even for Al's number one Chicago's Italian Beef.
What?
First of all, what Hall of Fame is Moose Cholak in?
Bob Luce's?
Yeah, the Bob Luce Hall of Fame. Second of all, Bob Luce is the host of the commercial. He's the guy holding the mic and pitching, and he's the one who goes nuts at the end of the commercial, not the wrestler.
Actually, wait a second. At the little thing at the end that appears to be from whatever show this was airing as part of, it looks like Bob Luce is one of the guys there.
That's the next commercial. That's Bob Luce with Leon Spinks.
Oh, that's Leon Spinks. I couldn't tell because it went by so quick. Okay.
Yeah, it's another classic Bob Luce commercial moment. Apparently there were a whole string of Bob Luce commercials in Chicago.
So what was Al's Chicago Italian Al's Chicago Wait, Al's no, oh, Al's number one Chicago's Italian Beef?
I think it's exactly what it says.
Is it a sandwich shop?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a giant Al's Chicago Beef sign behind them. It's cheap.
But the name, too, that it's Al's number one Chicago's, the two apostrophes.
I like how Moose Cholak says he needs a third hand to eat all this. He looks like he's doing just fine with his two hands. It doesn't look like he's having any problems whatsoever.
What a strange name, though. Is it a cheesesteak place? Is it a...
Al's number one Chicago Italian Beef. Al's number one Chicago. I guess Al's number one is the name.
The name is actually Al's number one, and then the subtitle is Chicago's Italian Beef.
Yes.
That's helpful. 100% top rated beef.
Oh, yes.
That reminds me.
Isn't that Vince McMahon's, isn't that what he called the WBF?
100%. Oh, I was just going to bring that up. 100% tested prime beef or whatever. And he also had it on WWF too. So, yeah. So was the idea that it was supposed to be a drug-free thing, 100% tested, but they're still beefy?
That's the word that kind of throws it off. And who was testing it? Was it Vince doing the testing?
Dr. Mauro Di Pasquale.
Yeah, whatever happened to him?
I think he's still an expert of some kind in that field. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right. Well, we're not going to let go of Bob Luce just yet. We have one more Bob Luce commercial we're going to play, and that is Bob Luce with Bobo Brazil. And Bobo will say something in his commercial about this liquor store that they're advertising that Bix and I both found questionable. Bix, play this tape.
And I do want to point out, this one has a date. This one says it's from Chicago Challenge Wrestling in 1989, whatever that means. So here we go.
In this corner for one stop, the world's greatest black wrestler, Bobo Brazil. Tell him, Bobo.
I shop in Chicago at one stop, where I buy beer and chitlins by the case. I love their spare ribs by the 30-pound boxes. That is the way I buy. And one stop sells it at the lowest price.
Thanks, Bobo, for that money-saving tip. Remember, one-stop fans, Chicago's famous food and liquor supermarket. One location only, 4301
South Lake Park. 7 days a week.
One stop.
Chitlins by the case?
And ribs? And also, this does not look like it's from 1989, by the way.
No, none of this does. Anything Bob Luce did, it looks like it's from the late 70s.
Chitlins? Wait, so did the liquor store sell chitlins and ribs?
Yeah. That's almost as crazy as a pizza place selling muffins. I mean, some of these places are just really wacky. But there you go. There's everyone's, for those of you who aren't aware of Bob Luce, just Google him and get stuck in a wormhole of Bob Luce. Go watch tapes of him narrating wrestling. You'll lose your mind. You'll be like, oh, this action's great. Why is this guy yelling at me?
He's like a guy on a TV show playing a pro wrestling announcer.
He's over the top. He's just so over the top. Bob Luce. Didn't his collection just get sold or something?
The non-videotape and film parts went to, what's his name? Why am I forgetting his name all of a sudden?
Billy Corgan. And what about the film and the video from his collection?
I think it's still... I wonder if it's possible if Corgan bought it physically, but not...
Mentally?
Didn't want to buy anything that they said was a license in case WWE had a claim. That was apparently why he didn't want to even try to go for
WWE. WWE doesn't have any claim on that.
That's another matter for another day.
Yeah, but they don't. How many more commercials we have for today, Bix?
We have two more, and we keep going in the Midwest with a Mad Dog Vachon commercial.
This may be the best one. This may be the very best one. I know Scott Cornish out there agrees with me. This may be the very best one.
And it's for a beverage wholesaler, I guess is the politically correct term.
Oh, play it. Just play it.
In Minneapolis. Okay.
No wonder. Look at this mountain of beer. I never seen such selection in all my life. Local beer, United States beer, Canadian beer, imported beer. No wonder with their prices. And they told me, dude, this was an easy part-time job. Don't I ever get a coffee break around here?
Chicago Lake Liquor is the number one beer store. Buy for less. Save even more on 3K special. Number one, Chicago Lake Liquor.
That's a real dichotomy there between the two voices you hear in that commercial. They got the most professional voiceover guy along with Mad Dog Vachon. You all right over there, Dix?
I like that it suddenly pivots to that he's working part-time there.
Well, you know, Vern wasn't well known for his paydays.
I thought he was.
Was? I thought it wasn't that he paid the best, but you got lots of time off.
I thought it was a well-paying territory that just didn't pay as well as it should have.
You know, I don't know. I always thought that it didn't pay the greatest, but you got plenty of time off to do whatever you wanted.
I thought the trade-off, though, was the pay versus the weather. And plus, well, the time off, too, but...
I don't know.
My understanding was the top three biggest money territories in the late 70s were WWF, then... And then the next two, I'm not sure which would be two and which would be three, were AWA and Crockett.
Well, you know, we have to get Greg Gagne on the show to ask him.
No.
Oh, yeah. You're just afraid he's going to just say nothing but lies and you're going to like sit there and have to hold your tongue.
Because that's exactly what would happen.
Oh, come on. There has to be some honesty. I haven't seen the new kayfabe commentaries he did with Cornette. That I want to see.
I've heard that it looks like Jimmy's doing what you just said I would be afraid that I would have to do.
Oh, no.
Sit there and hold my tongue the whole time.
Oh, no. Well, look, who are you to disrespect the man who created the NWO and the UFC and had the AWA on CBS almost and did all these amazing things? I like Greg Gagne. I'd like to talk to him.
And is one of many people to get WCW sued for racial discrimination.
Was Greg involved with that?
Charlie Norris, because he was named in Charlie Norris's lawsuit because he tried to explain to Charlie Norris how to properly do a rain dance in a pro wrestling context.
Well, was he doing it wrong?
Apparently.
Yeah. Isn't Charlie Norris actually a Native American?
Yes.
Oh, Jesus. I'm just picturing him standing in the locker room wearing his outfit and Greg Gagne is doing the war dance around him in his suit.
That's probably exactly what happened.
That's actually really, really funny. Where's Travis Heckle? There's your artwork. All right. One last commercial for this week. Then we got to move on, Vix.
Yes. So if you look on YouTube, especially on the channel of Mr. Moop, who has a number of wonderful pro wrestling videos, most of which I had never seen before, it seems like Lou Albano did commercials for just about every business in Putnam County, New York. There are a lot. When I asked on YouTube, I asked on Twitter, everyone from the area was like, yes, he did a, it was hard to find something he did not do a commercial for. So there are several. My favorite is this one from 1988 for Kent Pharmacy. Now, if you look it up, he has a lot more. He has for a Greek restaurant and stuff, but I think this one is the best, and you'll see why. And this one's also longer than the other commercials we had. This one's a minute long, so just
oh boy,
it seems like it keeps going. That's why.
Well, hold on before you play it. Is this Albano pre or post vodka?
Pre or post vodka? Oh, I was thinking you were. I was thinking you were saying like a macro. Is this like pre or post something?
No, is this after stuff? Is this after he stopped drinking?
I don't know when he stopped drinking. That's what
I think. When he lost all the weight, he stopped drinking.
This is before he lost all the weight. He lost all the weight in like 92, 93.
Okay, so this is before then. Okay, cool. Yeah.
Didn't he go vegetarian or something too? Or at least say he did?
I don't know. Oh. I really don't know.
Well, he wasn't getting fired all of a sudden from different places. So I guess maybe that's what going vegetarian means. That went over like a lead balloon.
Yeah.
Here's the commercial, everybody.
Let's hear this.
Get ready, because it's coming on the 31st. Goblins, ghosts, and witches, we got it all. Come on down to the Kent Pharmacy on Route 52 in Kent, New York. We've got hair nets, we've got sprays, we've got cosmetics, we've got prescription drugs, we've got it all together. We've got masks, we've got swords, we've got costumes for all occasions. Anything you want, we've got, and then some. Now come on down, remember the name, Kent Pharmacy. Also, during the month of October, we've got outrageous sales, 20 to 50% off on selected gifts and merchandising. Remember, I'm Captain Lou, and I'm talking to you about the Kent Pharmacy, the finest pharmaceutical outlet in the entire area. It's Captain Lou telling you to come on in, browse around, check the selections. I want you to meet the fine staff. Remember, Captain Lou talking about the Kent Pharmacy, Route 52, Kent, New York. Kent Pharmacy, remember that name.
I think they would have done okay with a 30-second spot.
How much could that have actually boosted business? I mean, it's just, it's all over the place.
I like how also it's all Halloween stuff, but in the middle, we've got prescription drugs.
Yeah, we've got prescription. We've
well,
got swords.
Pharmacy.
We've got swords. We've got prescription drugs. He's been around too many wrestlers. That's why he went right with the, we got prescription drugs. He knew his
Well, I'd hope they have prescription drugs.
Yeah. What kind of pharmacy does it? But they got swords. You got all kinds of masks. It's amazing. It is amazing that he was just like, you know, because if that was the late 80s, that was when he was doing Super Mario.
Yes.
So, I mean, he was like on TV all the time, but he's doing these like tiny little commercials in his like hometown or like in the area of his hometown.
Yeah.
He lived in what? Carmel, New York.
Carmel's Putnam County.
Yeah.
Also, one thing you don't get by only listening to this, so you have to look this up on YouTube, and I'm sure it'll be in the playlist for everyone to see it. He has a lapel mic, but for some reason it is not attached to his shirt, and he's just holding it in his fist with his fist balled up next to his face.
Yeah. I mean, you know. I by the way, I think I answered my question. This is before he gave up drinking.
I would hope so.
Yeah, I'm pretty positive of that now. Well, this was our commercial segment this
Why
week.
Why was that a minute long?
Because for this reason, for so we could play it on this show this day. Yeah, I mean, it got like halfway, and I was like, I can't go much longer. I wasn't timing it. I was like, that has to be a minute. And then it just kept going and going and going.
You had about a 20 to 30 seconds worth of material in there, at most. And then he just starts yelling.
I'm Captain Lou.
He just starts yelling, I'm Captain Lou telling you, Kent Pharmacy, Kent Pharmacy, Kent Pharmacy, over and over.
I need to find his NRBQ commercial and get that up here. That is my favorite one, I think. Oh, well. Well, we'll revisit this again at a later time. The wrestlers in commercials. Thank you for everyone who participated in sending us clips. And obviously we have a big thread for it on Facebook.com/superpodcast. And
yes,
we'll continue to add to it as these things come up. And,
yes. And you know, I did want to thank I'd have to check again who it was because I didn't leave it open. But whoever posted the Paul Orndorff Absorbine Jr. commercial, which I had been wanting to see just because of the whole story behind it, where he got it booked on his own. WWF was upset because they wanted like 20% of his $5,000 or whatever. Thank you for posting it. We didn't play it because there's no dialogue.
But I never knew that story.
I may have the numbers wrong, but it's something like that.
When did that happen?
Whenever this was, 86 maybe?
So it was in the middle of his run with Hogan?
Quite possibly.
Wow. Who successfully went into business for themselves while working there? I mean, Jesse Ventura, obviously, is the big one. Piper filmed Body Slam in the middle of him working there, right?
Yes. King Kong Bundy had that computer ad that apparently did well. He did well with and allegedly got some stock options with or something. So there's that. I'm not sure if I can think of anyone else.
Yeah, because everything with Hogan was commissioned through the office.
Just about everyone else was commissioned through the office.
Yeah. So really, that may be it. Piper, Orndorff, Ventura.
Well, Orndorff wasn't really sick. Orndorff just got the one thing, though.
Yeah, but still, he got something.
Persist. He got something, and then he got heat over it.
You know, Sergeant Slaughter wasn't allowed to do G.I. Joe. That's why he left to do G.I. Joe.
Yep.
So, anyway, Bix, we have a – before we even get to our book of the week, I just want to say coming up next, we have something really, really cool. We had a long talk with John McAdam, and we've been building up for weeks that we're talking with people about – old school wrestling fandom, and the conversation just was so much fun that we're just going to run the whole thing today, give you a sample of the kind of things Bix and I have been talking about with different people. So hopefully everyone really enjoys it. It's a conversation that goes all over the place, covers all sorts of different things, but we had a blast talking with John, and he is definitely someone you will probably hear on the show again at a later time, because we really, really love talking with him and he has a lot of fun things to say. But before we get there, Bix, it's time for the book of the week.
Book of the week.
Book of the week.
Book of the week.
Book of the week. So what's the book of the week this week, Bix?
The book of the week this week, because we just had Mad Dog Vachon in the commercial segment, is Mad Dog, Midgets and Screwjobs, The Untold Story of How Montreal Shaped the World of Wrestling by...
That sounds like it could be the name of the Sue the Shooter book. Mad Dogs, Midgets and Screwjobs. I could do Sue the Shooter all day.
Call it Moondogs, Midgets and Screwjobs, and it's me.
But anyway, anyway,
that was good.
Thank you very much. I'll be here all week. So sorry to interrupt you.
Bad Dogs, Midgets and Screwjobs, The Untold Story.
Oh my.
Oh, you son of a Mad Dogs, Midgets and Screwjobs, The Untold Story of How Montreal Shaped the World of Wrestling by Pat LaPrade, and I believe, I always think I'm getting his name wrong, but Bertrand Hébert, I believe, is something approximating the way you pronounce his name. I know Pat, I don't really know Bertrand, so whatever. The book is about, as it says, the history of Montreal wrestling, but it covers everything from the local scene in terms of the various territories to the promotional wars to the WWF coming in and doing just tremendously well to how the WWF booked a lot of market specific stuff there because Pat Patterson felt they needed to keep it going to the point that people like Ron Garvin headlined during his WWF run when he was not headlining anywhere else because he was a local guy who had drawn well there for the local promotions. To covering the indie scene and guys like the men now known as Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. So there's a lot of really cool stuff in there that just covers a big cross-section. Of course, it does cover the Montreal Screwjob. It's like everything you'd ever want to know about Montreal wrestling is all in that book. And let me just get the page count because I remember it being fairly big. It's
pretty big. Yeah,
yeah, that's what Sue said. The printed edition is 423 pages. This is a large, detailed book.
Yeah, and you know, like Bick said before, if you're someone out there who's a fan and not really aware of it, I think to me the most fascinating stuff in that book is the stuff dealing with the 1970s promotional war in Montreal. That is fascinating stuff. That's where Andre the Giant comes out of. That's where you have people like Killer Kowalski and Donnelly O'Jonathan and the LeDucs and Mad Dog Vachon and Butcher Vachon. And it is just – it's amazing stuff. Really, really great work they did on this book. And if you're into hearing about promotional wars, you know, we talked a little bit lately about the Georgia promotional wars here on the show. Definitely check out this book. Definitely worth your time.
And you know what's fascinating about that promotional war? This is one where both promotions thrived as a result.
Yeah, it was kind of like the Monday Night Wars for a while there, where it's just both of their ratings went through the roof and both of their attendances went through the roof. It was the same thing there.
Yeah, I think when you compare the different ones, I guess it shows like the problem with the Knoxville promotional war, because that in a way, I feel like that's the most infamous of the territorial promotional wars, because it literally killed the city for wrestling for years, was that it just got too bitter with the lawsuits being public and the kayfabe breaking and the real names giving away, that whole thing.
Well, there's competing and then there's trying to destroy. Yes. And that the Knoxville promotion was all about the opposition all-star just trying to really kill Southeastern.
And it killed both of them.
And it killed everything for a long time.
I mean, to the point that like other promoters would come in, but over the next few years, it's just a hodgepodge. Georgia and Crockett and other people.
Yeah, Mulligan and Flair. Blackjack Mulligan just passed away. Him and Ric Flair are business partners. They bought the Knoxville promotion, and that didn't last too long.
Here's a question. Not to speak ill of the recently deceased.
But you will.
Thanks. Why didn't Mulligan think that was a good idea after what happened in Amarillo?
You know,
like 3 years earlier,
I think maybe he thought there was more potential there than Amarillo, that it had been a hot area in the past. Plus, he was going to be working with Flair, who he was probably I believe he was closer with than Murdoch. They were next door neighbors. They were best friends. They also knew that unlike Amarillo, which was, you know, in many ways in the middle of nowhere, they were going to be surrounded by friends. They were right outside the Crockett territory, right outside the Georgia territory. So that would be my hunch.
Wait, this is – I think I said 3 years. I think it was probably closer to two because I think it was 81, right?
81, I believe, yeah.
So this is 2-3 years max. So it's a little strange, I feel like, in that sense because of just how badly things went in Amarillo. But I don't know. I just thought that was
interesting. And by the way, you didn't speak ill of the dead in saying that. I think you're –
but I still prefaced it by saying – I just felt like I should –
the preface was the worst part.
You kind of
set yourself up and then didn't go there.
But yes, Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, the untold story of how Montreal shaped the world of wrestling. If you want to pick it up, please use our Amazon referral link. We'll have one directly to the book in the show description, and just for any of your – household needs. I started that sentence without realizing that I didn't have an ending for it.
It really could be household needs. You could buy a mop and a broom.
Well, you can get anything at Amazon, pretty much.
Light bulbs, paper.
You can get one of those
Pepsi AC.
What are those little buttons that Amazon sells now, where you press the button and it's connected to Wi-Fi?
Yeah, I don't know what it's called. Amazon Dash.
You can order an Amazon Dash button
and an Amazon Dawson. It's a joke for those NXT fans, but yes, you can order all sorts of paraphernalia.
And you know, those things, it's like they cost $5, but then you get a credit off the first order you do with them. But anyway, our referral URL is tinyurl.com/605Amazon. Go there, add stuff to your cart after. If you do it before, it doesn't count. Add stuff to your cart after going there. Check out. We get a little bit of a kickback. You don't pay anything extra. It helps us keep going with the show because we're putting way too much time into it. All for your enjoyment. but we're putting a lot of time into this.
Yeah, without any joking, this is becoming like a full-time thing for Bix and I, and we love it, and we're having fun with it. So this definitely helps us justify the time we're pouring into it. You know, we get a small fraction of what you pay to Amazon, and it's the same thing you would pay if you use Amazon regularly. It's just we get a cut because it comes to our referral code. And as Bix said previously on the show last week, that we also now have, you can get Amazon Prime if you sign up for a trial, even if you don't stick with it. You can cancel it right away. You get a 30-day trial of free shipping on everything, and you get access to their video on demand network. We would get a bit of a kickback for that too, even if you don't retain the program, even if you just sign up for Amazon Prime and cancel before the 30 days are up. So please consider that as well. And like Bix said before, it is tinyurl.com/605Amazon. And lots of other shows do this. Chris Jericho, Steve Austin, all sorts of big shows, small shows, comedy shows. Adam Carolla, as Bix has once pointed out.
And just, fuck those guys.
Well, you didn't do it right. And just remember, the way we say it here is, fuck those guys.
Oh, I see. It's the inflection. It's like,
and use the
fuck
hashtag.
Fuck those guys.
Use the hashtag fuck those guys.
Okay. And also, to be clear, for the Amazon Prime trial, you go to tinyurl.com/605Prime. It's separate. I don't know why they.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, you can't just go to the main page through the main one and then sign up.
And one last thing. I know a lot of our overseas listeners have said that they want to support the show, but they don't have that for their Amazon. We are going to be rectifying that situation pretty soon.
Yeah, I just need to really get it set up. But I already have some that I have set up on at least a couple of them. So we should be able to add 605 on. It should be a fairly simple process soon.
We'll be taking care of this very soon. So thank you for everyone who has reached out and said that they want to support the show from England or Australia or various other places. Hold tight a little bit longer. As long as it's not toilet paper or soap that you need, if it's a book, just hold on a little bit longer. We'll get you taken care of. And thank you for all the support and all the love for the show.
Indeed.
So now we're going to move on to continue our discussion with John McAdam, legendary tape trader. And this was really just a fun conversation, Bix, from top to bottom, wasn't it?
This was a lot of fun. And it was also the first of two times this week that I've talked to someone that I've known for like 16, 17 years. But first time I ever actually talked on the phone. Same thing with Tim Knoll on this week's Between the Sheets. So that was interesting.
Cool. So with that being said, here is the continuation of our discussion with John McAdam. We hope everyone enjoys it, and we'll be back on the other side. You know, John, one of the stories I remember that you were involved in was at Smoky Mountain Wrestling Fan Week in 1994, August of 1994. I was down there. I was 14 years old, and I remember there was a television taping, and for some reason, and I was told you were responsible for this in one way or another, New Jack came out with a Barbie doll in his mouth.
I am pedantic with dates. That was actually 1995.
No, it was 94.
It was the year we were in the van. And
no, because New Jack was gone
by
then, but in 95.
That's weird. Okay, well, here's the story, and you're right. You're absolutely right. He was gone by 95. Not sure why I have my dates confused, but we had gotten off. We were not on the Smoky Mountain bus. Maybe we rented a car at some point. I don't remember. And we stopped at McDonald's. And you realize how great McDonald's is because you know what you're getting as opposed to some of the food they got down there in the Smoky Mountain area. I am sorry. That stuff is putrid. But anyway, they were having some promotion where if you bought a certain meal, they gave you a Barbie doll. And so we have this Barbie doll. We're like in our 20s. We don't know what to do with it. Someone comes. I came up with the idea to go up to Brian Hildebrand and say, Brian, give this to New Jack as a peace offering from the fans in Saltville, Virginia. And Brian looks at me like, what are you, nuts? I'm like, just tell him that. What's he going to do? So and it was a total shoot, according to Brian. New Jack comes out with the Barbie doll in his mouth and spits it out. And he's like, here's what I think of your peace offering.
What are you thinking, though, sitting there when all of a sudden he comes out with, I mean, you couldn't have expected that.
I guess Brian played it completely straight, and he thought that was going on. I remember that TV taping. We were sitting way in the back, And I don't know why New Jack targeted the guy in front of us. Yeah, I guess he had a girlfriend. And New Jack looks at the girl and he looks at the guy and goes, I bet she wants to know what it's like to have a big, sweaty black man on top of her. And this guy's, the back of his neck turned bright red. He was so pissed that New Jack was talking to his girl like that. So, yeah, Salkle was fun.
That was a fun taping. I was in the front row, and most of the front row were fans from Fan Week. So we were smart, but we were trying to be respectful and, you know, boo the heels and cheer the baby faces. And we all just went at it with New Jack. He got in everyone's face, and it was pretty over the top. If he didn't know that we were there with Fan Week, it would have been scary. But because we kind of knew we were okay, it worked out all right. you know, you mentioned that you guys rented a van. That was the year of the Johnson City Death Bus. Do you remember that? What do you remember about that? Bix, do you know about the Johnson City Death Bus?
I know that there was a bus that was so bad that it led to many people swearing they wouldn't come back the following year.
I remember in 94, we were on this bus. We were headed to Johnson City. It was all the way, like, you know, far away. And the bus, like, wouldn't go more than 30, 35 miles an hour.
I think you're being a little gracious with your speedometer.
As always.
Yeah.
it was ridiculous. I think that's what led us to, you know, let's get a van instead of this thing. And, we wound up getting making our own itinerary the next year for our Smoky Mountain Fan Week.
So in terms of newsletter readers, tape traders, smart fans of the era traveling to shows, when exactly did that start? And how big was the group in general? And, you know, what are some of the memorable shows you guys went to?
Oh, let me see. As memorable shows, I went to... The most memorable show definitely was the 1989 Great American Bash. That was another one that Dennis was at. And it was memorable, A, because the show was so good, but B, the brawl between Ric Flair and Sting versus Muda and Terry Funk. What was seen on TV does not begin to give it justice. These guys were all over the place, like all over, you know, the arena floor. It was crazy.
Did you go to any of the other NWA shows in 89?
I went to an insane amount of NWA shows in 89. I went to Philly, I think, three times. They came up here. They did Boston. There was a canceled show the next night in Providence where I went down and got to hang out with some of the guys because they had nothing to do. And then the Monday night, they were in Springfield, Massachusetts. Let me see. There was the Boston Garden Show in 89, which was Terry Funk versus Sting, which was outstanding. Let me think. I went to Philly three times. I went to Baltimore once. I wanted to go so bad to Wrestle War 89, and there was just no way because of work. That's all I can think of off the top of my head. But I would say, you know, considering they never came up here, we went to a show in Philadelphia the night before the 1989 Great American Bash, and it was one of the best live shows I've ever seen, maybe even better than the pay-per-view. And it was the night Jim Cornette blew out his knee. I guess him and Paul Lee had all kinds of spots planned for the 89 Bash, and Terry Gordy right in front of me, like, messed up some move on Jim Cornette and, like, re-injured his knee that he destroyed at Starrcade 86. And Jimmy's right in front of me. God damn fucking Gordy! Jesus Christ, my fucking knee! You know, so that was a memory.
The Boston Garden Show that you mentioned, is that the one... Well, I guess I'll ask it this way. Were you part of the group that went up to Lance Russell and surprised him by being in Boston and knowing who he was since he had just started with the company?
I might have been. I walked up to Lance and introduced myself and told him that, you know, I had been to the Memphis studio the year before and met him there. And Lance, as always, was very nice. And I don't know if I wasn't part – was I part of a group? I don't know, but I definitely went up to Lance. Hey, well, I've got a cute story about that show.
Well, he always tells a story about how he had just started with WCW. He's at the Boston Garden, and may not have even been on TV yet, and all these fans are going up to him and, like, happy to meet him and, like, oh, my God, it's Lance Russell. And he says to him, like, which one of you guys is from Mississippi? Because, you know, that type of thing. And then they're, and then as he tells it, they're like, no, we're tape traders.
I don't believe I was part of that group. If I recall correctly, I walked up to Lance, you know, by myself and said hello to him.
Now, one thing I'll let you tell your story from that show. I'm trying to remember because I use the term now. Were you the one who would use the term NWA deadheads for this group of fans that would go around to the shows that I picked it up from? Or was it someone else?
It was probably someone else. Okay. I don't remember coming up with that one.
All right. So what was the story you had about the Boston show?
Doom is out wrestling whoever. Or excuse me, it was the Skyscrapers. And Teddy Long sees someone in the crowd. And he's like, I see that a major sports superstar came all the way to Boston to see my Skyscrapers. And ladies and gentlemen, Sugar Ray Leonard. Sugar Ray Leonard's in the audience. Well, you guys might not know this, but Sugar Ray Leonard is hated in Boston because this is Marvin Hagler country. And there was a brief, you know, yay, and then the building started to boo Sugar Ray viciously, and he had to leave. And Teddy, when he first heard the boos, you should have seen the look on his face, like, what the hell's going on here? I talked to Teddy about that one time. I ran into him. He's like, oh, yeah, he had no idea that, you know, Boston was Marvin Hagler country.
That Philly card you mentioned, because I know over the years, like, I know at least Dave Meltzer and Jeff Bowdrin would always talk about how the Luger Steamboat match on that card on the Bash Tour was actually better than the one in Baltimore at the pay-per-view the next night. So I'm trying to remember, what else is on that show, and, like, in what ways did those compare to the pay-per-view?
Okay, going by an almost over 25-year-old memory, Sting and Terry Funk tore the place up. They had, I want to say, the Freebirds and the SST against the Midnight and Doc and someone else, and they tore the place up. There was, like, three, like, four-star matches, and, yes, the Steamboat Luger match is arguably the best match I've ever seen live, ever. And it was definitely better than the Baltimore match.
Wow. Best match you have ever seen live, ever, of anything.
If it's not number one, it's in the team picture. I'm trying to think of one that was better, and off the top of my head, I can't.
And Lex called that match.
What's that?
And Lex called that match.
Hey, Lex was, you know, people, I understand that Lex got pretty terrible in, like, 91, 92 or so, but in 89, Lex looked like the future of the business.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was tremendous.
He was in that natural state of, you know, Lex, I've met Lex. He's not a bad guy, but he's a naturally arrogant guy. And they were just letting him kind of be that naturally arrogant guy with a little bit of coaching from, you know, Jim Cornette and whoever else. And it was working.
Yeah, 89 into 90, because even like the Stan Hansen feud, I mean, upped his game. And it definitely seemed like, you know, now there's this revisionist history that Lex was always terrible, that he was just a steroid guy. But, you know, look at 88, look at 89, look at 90. He was really, really good. And when he was a heel in 89, he was exceptionally good.
They absolutely killed him with that turn in 1990. It was way too early. It was just way too much of a reaction to, you know, and this is the way WCW was. It's like, hey, you know, it's like the world was going to end when this pay-per-view ended, so we might as well just burn everything and put everything into it. I will go to my grave saying that turn killed Lex Luger. And you know what? Talk about not understanding your audience. Think of your typical wrestling audience. Now, think about Lex Luger in 1990 with those bright orange trunks and trying to be smiley against Stan Hansen. Who are the fans going to cheer for?
Yeah.
And he put on too much size in 91, too, with that heel turn. I mean, it wasn't just the booking. He did slow down in the ring, I feel like.
No, I agree with you. But again, you know, it's a question of, and by that point, I think Lex was just, you know, hey, this is just a paycheck. I like to book big.
So here is the lineup for that Philly show at the Civic Center, which apparently drew 3,000 fans. Al Green and Ron Simmons defeated Scott Hall and Joey Maggs. That's an interesting – those are two very interesting tag teams right there.
Paul was so terrible in that promotion in 1989. I am surprised that he turned into as big a star as he did.
And then he just suddenly became a good worker when he became Razor Ramon, too.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. You know, Shawn Michaels did not carry that ladder match all by himself like people try to make that out.
No, and they had an absolutely tremendous match later that year on Raw, too, when Michaels came back from his post-ladder match hiatus.
Ah, that's right.
Yeah. Norman pinned Ranger Ross. Skyscrapers beat the Party Patrol.
Okay, that, believe it or not, was a good match because Davey Rich did that ridiculous spot where he gets clotheslined and he does like a 450 flip in the air. And Sid, like, you know, hey, look what I just did. Everyone's like, oh my God, Sid, you're so good. I'm like, oh man, poor Davey Rich.
You know, let's talk about that for a second. For people who weren't around at the time, explain the 1989 Smart Fans' love of Sid Vicious.
I don't think there was really Smart Fan love as much as it wasn't love. It was a basic evaluation where you look at that guy and he has that look and you're like, okay, I can see him doing a major program with Hogan, or I can see him doing like major heel stuff.
Plus, he sort of exuded a cool heel charisma at that time.
Yes, and they would also book him against guys that the Smart Fans hated, like the Party Patrol and the Dynamic Dudes.
I was saying, when we went to that Memphis taping in 1988, I had never seen a powerbomb live before, and we're in that small studio, and Sid powerbombs the crap out of someone. I forget who, but it was... intellectually, you know, it's kind of a harmless hold if done right, but it looked like Sid killed the guy. So I think that might have had something to do with why some Smart Fans loved him, because he did that move.
Right. And then you had Dynamic Dudes beat the New Zealand Militia, and then like the pay-per-view, the card really picks up in the second half. Mike Rotunda beat Scott Steiner in a suplex match. Kevin Sullivan beat Rick Steiner. Muta beat Gilbert in a coal miner's glove match, which sounds fantastic. How was that? Because I don't think any of the I started hearing you were like breathing, and I thought you were going to respond.
Oh, you say coal miner's glove match in Philadelphia, I get nightmares of when I was at Halloween Havoc in 92.
So. How was that though? Because every single match in that program, or at least the longer matches, were all house shows. So like they might have had a couple short TV matches.
It's possible. I don't remember how good Gilbert versus Muta specifically was. It probably was. I mean, you know, two excellent workers. I do remember, you know, Philadelphia had a very smart crowd, and a chant went up, Gilbert's turning tomorrow. Gilbert's turning tomorrow.
That's probably a reason why they ended up nixing it, because you idiots were chanting.
It wouldn't surprise me. Because I know for a fact that they did a taping the Saturday before the Baltimore pay-per-view, and I know that coming into that taping, the plan was to turn Eddie Gilbert. And, you know, it took them less than 48 hours to just change their mind on that. And I think that killed Eddie in the NWA. Like, he had no direction after that.
And then after that, yeah, Luger Steamboat, Sting, Terry Funk, no DQ match when Sting pinned an interfering Bill Irwin. Well, okay. And the two teams that would be in war games.
From Texas.
Close enough.
I spoke out of turn. I apologize. Go on, Dave.
It's fine. And then the Road Warriors, Dr. Death, Midnight Express beat the Freebirds and the SST in a Bad Street match.
And that match was way better. If I recall correctly, we all came away saying that match was way better than it sounded on paper.
Was it better than the War Games match was the next night?
I'd say yes, if only because I didn't think that much of the War Games match.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was all right.
So which were, like, of the pay-per-views and clashes, which did you go to in 89, besides the Bash?
Let me see. I think the only pay-per-view I went to was the 89 Bash. To this day, I kick myself for not going to New York Knockout. I absolutely could have gone Albany or Troy, wherever it is. It was like a 2.5 hour ride. I could have made it. And I just kind of decided at the last minute not to go. And I don't think I've ever been to a Clash. No, I haven't.
I love watching that show. Besides that match and the other good matches on the show, I just love how they pretend they're in New York City when they're in Troy.
Well, they're often confused, Troy and New York City. But that was such a cool show. Not only did you get that classic Ric Flair Terry Funk match, and I kind of knew it was at least supposed to be Terry's last match. He was going to retire after that. But like Luger taking the chairs and destroying the trophies was simply awesome. And how could I forget? I did go to Halloween Havoc 89.
And that was in Philly. So that must have been interesting.
It was definitely, it wasn't that good a show, but what was incredibly cool about it, Dave Meltzer comes up to me. He's like, come here, quiet. He's like, you cannot tell anyone this. I'm like, what? He's like, I'm going up to Terry Funk's room. Come with me. And I'm like, I can't. And he's like, why? I'm like, I'm here with Tom Robinson. I can't just ditch him. He's like, okay, you can bring Tom along. And we got to hang out with Terry Funk. I want to say like 5 hours. Wow. And Terry sucked down, I want to say, 2 packs of Cools and an entire case of Coors. And he was an awesome guy.
That sounds about right.
Dave Meltzer, if you're listening, I am eternally grateful to you for that. Thank you.
I want to take a step back, John. You mentioned the Boston Garden before, and that was your home arena for many, many years. So being in New England, being around Boston, what are your first memories of the Von Erichs? And did you watch it on TV when it was airing in New England? When was that? And how big was that to that wrestling audience?
Okay. February 83, my phone rings and someone says, turn on channel 25. World Class Championship Wrestling is on. And I turn it on and it's Kerry Von Erich fighting Michael Hayes. As WWE, you guys know your WWF stuff. They didn't have anything like that on TV.
No.
You might maybe got 3 main events a year. These guys had a main event or at least 1 main event every week. And there was a shift. This was my senior year in high school. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there were now female wrestling fans in my school. World Class on Channel 25. It was on the same time as WWF wrestling. I don't know why. But, I generally would flip back and forth on the shows. And, yeah, all of a sudden, there were girls in my school who liked wrestling. That year, when was it? September 83, I'm at the Boston Garden. And what they used to do before the last match is they would tell you the card for the next month. And at the end, they say, oh, and we have a bonus match. SD, Special Delivery Jones, will be taking on Michael Hayes of the Fabulous Freebirds. The Garden melts down. Everyone watched that show.
Oh, man.
And I don't know what the story was behind that announcement, because we're all like, wow, Michael Hayes is going to be here next month. And everyone in the crowd remembered it, but it was never mentioned on TV, and it was not – the match wasn't in the program, and the match never took place.
So you mentioned in 83, it's on at the same time as WWF, and you're going back and forth. I'm guessing you're watching World Class except for when Don Morocco's on TV. Am I wrong in guessing that?
No, actually, I what I tried to keep up with was, and how frustrating. There's like 1 hour of – no, coming into this, there were 2 hours of wrestling not on cable on local TV, and then another show shows up at the same time as the main WWF show. So I wanted to keep up with the Boston Garden interviews, but that's pretty much it.
How long was World Class on Channel 25?
They were on – they left in the middle of 87, I want to say.
Oh, wow. That's
so
a long run.
25 stuck around.
Yeah. And did you go – when the Von Erichs came up to the area, were you there?
Believe it or not, only twice. They went to – the first show at the Manning Bowl, and we decided not to go to the second show because Lynn, Massachusetts was just a pain in the neck to get to, and it was really a dangerous area. I mean, you know, we're like early 20s, and if, you know, you're looking at us saying, "Oh, well, I don't want to go to Lynn," like that tells you how dangerous it is. But we went to a show. I went to the first Manning Bowl show, and then the next year they came up and they went to Providence, Rhode Island, at the Providence Civic Center. And the main event was Kevin Von Erich against Buzz Sawyer, and you want to talk about a bomb scare. There had to be like 250 people in this building that held like 12,000.
Wow.
It was pretty ugly. I'd never seen anything quite like that before. And some of the fans were booing Kevin Von Erich, and Kevin got into it with them, so at least that happened.
Well, let me ask you this, John. So I think – your name is well known amongst people who were tape traders back in the day. And also, you know, your name is one that people would see in the Observer. I remember specifically, I want to say the either 88 or 89 yearbook. You know, you were one of the featured people there with quotes after each award. So in terms of I guess what would now only be called smart fandom, you know, in many ways, hardcore fans, it was called for a long time before hardcore wrestling became an actual specific style. When did you get your first VCR? When did you get your second VCR? And what were you taping at the beginning?
Okay. I got my first VCR summer of 1985. I forget what I paid for it, but I got it at the local video store. It was used, so it was relatively cheap and affordable, and I grabbed it. And I did not record any wrestling at first. As a matter of fact, one of my friends calls me up and he's like, "Hey, Battle of the Belts 1 aired up here." He's like, "Yeah, I've got that on tape if you want to see it." I'm like, "I've already seen it." So that's a little bit of a surprise to some people.
Yeah.
Then in 86, it dawned on me that, wow, I sure would like to see some wrestling from 81 or 82 or whatever. And I said, wow, maybe I'll feel that way in 4 years about this wrestling. So I just, like, you know, if there was a good match on or whatever, I would tape it, keep it, and move on. Then I came up with an idea on my own. And you have to understand, there's no communication amongst wrestling fans back then. You know, you had your friends that you watched with, and that was it. And all information you got was what was on TV and what was in the magazines, which was basically nothing. You had no way of knowing anything. But I came up with the idea. I'm like, you know, I sure would like to see, I don't know, Mid-South wrestling, Memphis wrestling, whatever. And every now and then I would write a letter to someone whose address was like in Wrestling Eye or one of the Kaicher magazines. I would just say, hey, you know, I get this, you know, this is the list of the wrestling that I get. I would be interested in trading tapes with you. I don't think I heard back from anybody until one night I got home ridiculously late from a Christmas party. I want to say like 3:30. And I come in, and when I was in my 20s, I was in and out of my parents' house. And at this point, I was back in. And there are three mailings for me, and I open it up, and it's the Wrestling Observer newsletter. You want to talk about the Holy Grail, man. Yeah. I mean, it was incredible, the stuff they had in there. I mean, just stuff that, you know, I totally was not supposed to know. Recaps of all the televisions. It's timely. It was incredible. There's no other word to use. And I was up until like 6:30 reading this stuff, just being blown away, saying, okay, I'll just look at the front page of this one and that'll be it. And then you can't put it down. And then the next day was Saturday and another one showed up. So I was like just blown away by this, you know, this peek behind the curtain that I got. And believe it or not, I subscribed.
How did they arrive? Did you write a letter to Dave Meltzer after seeing his name and address in a magazine, or?
That's exactly what happened. I wrote to him, and I'm like, you know, I think they have Mid-South out there in California. If you're interested, I'd like to make a trade. You know, please write me back if you're interested. And he sent me a month sample of the Observer, and life-altering event.
So back then, the Observer still had the readers' pages, a missed feature in the Wrestling Observer newsletter. How long before you start advertising in there that you're looking for things or that you have things for trade?
Pretty much right away. I think I did it the first time I sent a check to Dave, and I got a response from a gentleman named Brian Trammell, who's part of our little Facebook group. And he's like, you know, I'm really not looking to trade anything, but if you'd like to purchase my Memphis tapes, you know, that would work for me. And I did that, and now I had Memphis wrestling to trade. So now from that point on, I was trading for everything.
And what was your thought seeing all these different territories for the first time, seeing a Memphis, seeing a Mid-South, as someone who grew up seeing the World Wrestling Federation and then World Class? And I don't know when you got cable, but eventually you would have seen WCW or what was then Jim Crockett Promotions. But what did you think of these other new territories you were being exposed to?
Memphis at first was phenomenal, and then in a weird way it got old quickly. Like, you know, oh, this is only the third or fourth run and we've had this 90-minute show. but, you know, moving a little bit backward, I actually knew how bad WWF television was because I used to get this show on cable called World League Wrestling, and they had matches from the Knoxville territory. They had the old Mid-South matches. And they went off the air, didn't go off the air, but they were replaced by Championship Wrestling from Florida, like beginning to mid-1980. And that show was incredible. And it went away like right around mid-1981. But I knew there was stuff out there that blew the WWF away. I mean, you could just read the magazines and you're like, you know, this stuff has got to be better than the WWF. It sure seems like a lot more interesting.
Yeah, that's right. So you're getting the Observer. When do you start seeing or subscribing to other newsletters?
Oh, not, you know, truthfully, I think when like I met Wade Keller in 88 and he's like, come on, man, subscribe to my newsletter, that sort of thing. I think it was that and John Gallagher's Wrestling Forum, because we had mutual friends and someone said, oh, come on, subscribe to John's newsletter. And I did. And he had a good newsletter. You know, I don't want to make it sound like his or Wade's newsletter was bad. It's just, you know what? Truth be told, the Observer was all you needed. If you wanted like opinion pieces or editorials, you wanted more, okay, there are other newsletters out there. But, you know, you had everything you needed with the Observer.
So, I mean, it's a pretty quick time from when you start getting the Observer to when your name is featured in, as I said, those yearbooks as one of the very few people who, for almost every award, your opinions and thoughts and views are displayed. How did you build up that sort of credibility with Dave?
I'm not sure. I think that, you know, Dave maybe saw me, I mean, you know, as someone who, you know, whenever I talked to him, I had a ton of questions. You know, I was an avid fan of the business for so long. And, you know, you talk to other people and, you know, I think they just figured I picked up on it kind of quick.
When do you start forming relationships with other fans that whose names you see in the newsletters?
Let me see. Pretty much right away, because sometimes you would facilitate a trade much quicker by actually getting on the phone with someone. So I would call, I don't know, Tom Robinson, Brian Trammell, whatever, and you would form a friendship and also an extra large phone bill. But that's another.
Yeah, a forgotten part of wrestling fandom, the phone bills.
Yeah.
What, you know, in those early days of tape trading, what were the holy grails? What were the things that everyone was looking for that no one can get their hands on?
Oh, to this day, it's the Ric Flair versus Bob Backlund match from the Omni, which I'm convinced was never recorded. But what did people really want? They wanted old Mid-South was big. Old Memphis was big. Old Mid-Atlantic was big. I mean, you know, it the good stuff. And there was a lot in the Northeast. There was a real demand for old WWF. Hey, let's relive our childhood stuff. So if you had WWF TV from the 70s, like, you know, people were all over that.
So you've been watching the WWF for, you know, years throughout your childhood. What are you thinking when all of a sudden all the radical changes to the television start happening in 1984? All of a sudden, Gene Okerlund's a color commentator, Roddy Piper, who you're probably aware of at that point, is on TV. Hulk Hogan, the biggest star in wrestling, both in America and Japan at that time, is on TV. What did you think was going on when all of a sudden everything started changing with their TV?
I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I figured out right away what was going on when I saw that the WWF was now having shows outside of the WWF territory. As far as what I thought of it, I really liked Hogan. I was so tired of Bob Backlund by the time he lost his the title that, you know, anyone would have done. But now you've got this charismatic, kick-ass babyface Hulk Hogan that everyone just fell in love with. Roddy Piper, I mean, who couldn't like Roddy Piper? They were bringing, I mean, every week you would turn on TV and there would be a new wrestler from, you know, from somewhere else. And I'm like, how are they going to use all of these guys? What I didn't like, and my friends definitely didn't like, was the goofy stuff like Gene Okerlund being a carnival barker, the overall kind of dopey direction the company was going in. Not to get on a tangent, but, you know, people cried, oh, Vince Russo ruined wrestling. No, Vince McMahon ruined the wrestling I grew up on with that, you know, that TNT show. I mean, that's a bigger slap in the face than anything Russo's done.
Yeah. And
he was going with a lot more cartoonish characters, a lot, you know, the message was clear, do not take this stuff seriously. And I'm part of me looking back, I don't want to say I'm surprised they survived, but they definitely reinvented the wheel.
Yeah, that's for sure. And they were running regularly in Boston at the Boston Garden. And as we said earlier, that was your home arena. Tell me about the Boston Garden. What was it like? What were the fans like? What are some of the most memorable matches and shows you remember seeing there?
Okay, I've been to Madison Square Garden. I've been to a bunch of different arenas. There's something, and Bill Apter actually backed this up because he had been to the Boston Garden. There was something in the air in the Boston Garden that just made people like violent and crazy. And this went for Bruins games too. But if you went to wrestling at the Garden, you could count on seeing at least 10 fights in the stands per card. I remember a couple of times, like, the wrestlers would, like, go into a rest hold and just sit there and watch the fights. the old – I mean, I have a lot of great memories from the old Boston Garden, make no mistake. I'm sorry that it's gone, but at the same time, it was such a dirty, crummy old – arena with tiny seats. I remember the summer of 82, we were in the middle of a heat wave and we pull into Boston and there's like a, you know, the bank signs have like the time and the temperature, and it said the temperature was 104 degrees and the Boston Garden did not have air conditioning. And we go in there and you could tell this was going to be a night to remember, because you got these drunk Boston idiots without their shirts on, sweating, and you just knew it was going to be an ugly night. And it was, man. There must have been 25 fights that night.
You've talked about
the show stunk because it was too hot to work.
So on that note, I think you've talked about in the past, I don't remember if it was message board posts on Facebook or what, the first King of the Ring at Foxborough Stadium. It was either the first or the second. That I believe you said that the show, not only was the show terrible, there were more fights in the crowd than you've ever seen in any wrestling show, and the wrestlers would actually stop what they were doing to watch the fights.
Yeah, Foxborough was the same thing as Boston as far as having like crazy rowdy fans. And again, this went for New England Patriots games too. As an aside, I was at a Patriots game in the dead of winter in 86. I saw a guy, it was like ridiculously cold, but I got to see a guy in his underwear fighting a guy in a gorilla suit. So right there, that's Foxborough in a nutshell. But what? Yeah, this show in 85 was, I mean, it was just crazy. The whole crowd had been tailgating in the parking lot. There were 20,000 drunks, and the wrestling was just God awful.
Like, define how awful, though, because we are talking about a very long WWF tournament show at the height of,
you know, bad travel and bad, weird scheduling. Like, how bad? Like, what would you compare this to on, like, the barometer of bad shows? Whether major shows or just stuff you've seen or whatever.
Go into a room, turn off all the lights, have no music or television, and just lay there for a couple of hours. It was worse than WrestleMania 4. Oh, wait, I'm sorry, but there was the excitement of the drunks, so there's that. But then we're talking about the actual product. There's no word in the English language. Abysmal. And I was used to WWF shows. I know, you know, it wasn't JCP. So by mid-80s WWF standards, this was just insane bad.
Let me ask you this, John. Actually, before I get to talking about your time as a promoter, and you are one of the very few fans who can say they put their money where their mouth was, and instead of just ranting about wrestling or writing about wrestling, you became a promoter and promoted wrestling and gave it a try.
Yes, I became a miserable failure, because you go right ahead.
But before I get there, I'm just curious, you know, you being involved as a promoter in that area and you growing up going to wrestling shows in that area, did you ever have any interactions with Killer Kowalski?
Yes, I did. If you're a Killer Kowalski fan, you might want to skip past this part, because I was not a big fan of his at all. Basically, he told everyone in the area that if they wrestled on our shows, he would not book them on his shows, and he would, even if you had paid your tuition in full, he would kick you out of his school, which I didn't think was very cool.
Whoa.
So I actually arranged a meeting with Kowalski and his partner Richard Byrne, Richard Byrne is the most miserable human being that ever lived. And we sat down. I just explained. I started by handing Kowalski a videotape. I said, "Mr. Kowalski, you know, this is for you. No matter how this meeting turns out, it has a bunch of your old matches on it." He said, "Oh, thank you very much." And he seemed like a nice enough guy. And I told him that he was someone who got me into wrestling, because it was the Strongbow and White Wolf versus Executioner's feud that turned me into a super casual fan, to like a killer hardcore fan. So I sat down with him and I said, "Look, you know, we're no threat to you. I will be happy to promote your school. I will not book anyone on days that you have shows. We will completely, you know, not step on your toes at all." And they agreed. And then the next day, for no reason, they decided to go back on the agreement. Just, you know, "No, we're not doing it. Sorry." So believe it or not, and he did kick a couple of guys out of his school that paid for their tuition in full. So that's kind of a downer.
What do you think that's about? What was he so afraid of?
I don't know. I think maybe it's just how promoters are, okay? I mean, just a lot of them are like that. Like, "No, this is my territory and no one else runs it." Number two, I have the feeling that, and you know, in fairness, the guy didn't know me. You know, what if it got big, and what if I decided, aha, I am big enough now to step on your toes, and there's nothing you can do about it? And hand on my heart, that's something I would have never done. But, you know, I guess he has to look at that as a possibility.
So your company is UCW. Tell us a little bit about the origins of it and what made you decide to do it.
I had a friend, his name was Jody Boynes. He came up with the idea that, you know, a lot of the local guys we felt were not being used correctly. He had access to public access cable, not only the cable station, but the cable station's equipment. So we could use that equipment to kind of, to do tapings and shop a tape around. And he's like, "Let's give this a go." And I said, "Okay." And we got in on it, and that's how it all started. This is winter, fall 91.
And where do you get your talent from?
Basically, you know, local independent guys. There was a promotion and a school that ran out of New Bedford, Massachusetts. There was Kowalski's bunch of guys. There used to be a wrestling column in the newspaper in the Boston Herald. And I wrote to them like, you know, hey, if you're a wrestler, a referee, or a manager, and you're interested, please send a tape. We got zero applications for wrestlers, but we got about 50 from fans who wanted to be managers.
That sounds familiar.
I don't know why it wouldn't, because I've heard that story before, but it's just a classic case of everyone thinks they can do it.
Now, did you say Cody Boynes or Jody Boynes?
Jody with a J. There were two of them.
Okay. What's the distinction here then? I thought I misheard you. So who is Jody Boynes? Because I know Cody Boynes from the various hotlines and stuff he was on.
No, they were brothers. Cody and Jody were not their real names.
I hope not.
But I have seen them in the same place at the same time. So they're definitely two different guys.
So, I mean, one of the names you use, I guess the name that stands out the most to me when I'm thinking back without looking at a roster or anything, was Bill Wilcox. What did you think of him?
I thought the world of him. I made him my top star. He wasn't particularly good on the mic, but I would tell him, Bill, if you just go out there and be yourself, don't do a wrestling promo. Just talk about, you know, the match and how you're going to beat the guy. But he was a spectacular wrestler, and he was doing stuff. You know, he wasn't a big guy. He was probably legit 225, which to me is a big guy. And he was big enough to be pushed, and his athleticism was off the charts, and he could do things that, like, just got people out of their seats.
You know, I guess the sad thing for Bill Wilcox is the one thing that he's probably most remembered for amongst people who remember him is the match with the Lightning Kid for Dennis Caraluzzo, where Sean Waltman was knocked out.
Yeah. Dennis, I sent Dennis a tape of one of our shows, and Dennis calls me up and he's like, look, man, there are four guys in this business. They're going to be big fucking stars. Okay. Brian Christopher, Sean Waltman, I forget the other guy, and Bill Wilcox. This kid has it. I'm going to book him. And the first match, everything goes south. The other guy was, I was going to say Brian Christopher, but no, I already said him. So, yeah, and it totally just – Dennis didn't want to use him anymore, and Waltman didn't like him, and he did it all wrong, obviously. Waltman got knocked out, and he dragged him back into the ring. I'm like, ah. So that hurt Wilcox. I also sent a tape to Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and Bill Apter called me, and he's like, I want to do a feature on this kid introducing Bill Wilcox, and you know, because Apter was that impressed with him. And Wilcox had a deal where he went over to Austria to wrestle, and he got booked by Otto Vons, and something went sideways between the two of them, and Vons tried to have him hurt for real in a match, and Bill just packed his bags and went home, and I think that dampened his enthusiasm for the wrestling business greatly.
So you start UCW in late 91. How long did it run, and you know, tell us, what are some of the things you encountered as a promoter? What were the highlights of the company? What were the lowlights of the company?
We actually started, let me think, it was May 92 was our first show. We booked five shows that were TV tapings. And then we tried to come back in 93 as just doing arena shows. And someone used the word snake bitten. Our first show, there was a blizzard and we could not have the show. The second show, we had a bad enough snowstorm where we couldn't have a show. And by then I had just given up. Oh wait, no, that's not true. We eventually had a show. It drew a reasonably sized crowd, but the building decided they did not like the content and decided not to have us anymore. And at that point I was like, that's it. I've had it with this.
What kind of content?
Wilcox was doing in the middle of an angle where he got into a brawl and he slammed a chair down. It's, you know, a steel chair or whatever. And, you know, wow, it didn't hurt the floor. It didn't hurt the chair. But the guy who ran the place was like, that's it. You know, we're not doing this.
You know, being a promoter in New England, being a fan in New England, when was the first time you saw Triple H, Paul Levesque?
The first time I saw him was when he was in WCW. I just heard, wow, this guy from Kowalski School is getting a push, or at least has a job in WCW. But he's from right here in Nashua. He went to the same high school that I went to, and his mom used to work with my mom.
Huh, interesting.
Yet, out of the hundreds of wrestlers that I have met, I have never met him.
Wow. Yeah, I wondered
if he was... My mom's met him, my brother's met him, one of my former girlfriends has met him, but I have not met him.
He's avoiding you for some reason.
For good reason.
Yeah. Well, on the topic of wrestlers you've met, you know, back when you were traveling to shows or back when you were just going to shows with your friends, once you started reading The Observer, once you started trading tapes, what wrestlers were cool with the smart fans and what wrestlers really weren't?
The very first wrestling show I went to as part of, like, you know, ooh, I'm with another smart fan, like Tom Robinson, Jamie Ward, a couple other people. We went to the hotel where they were staying, and every wrestler was like, nope, sorry, I got to go up to my room. This included like the Rock and Roll Express, Dusty Rhodes, you know, the top baby faces. And the one exception were three guys taking pictures, signing autographs, just being incredibly accommodating. And that's Jim Cornette, Stan Lane, and Bobby Eaton, the bad guys.
Yeah.
And Jimmy, you know, he is an absolute sweetheart. I know he went sideways with Wade Keller about something. And then there was like the tape where he got mad at the fast food lady. But, you know, I mean, we all have our bad moments. And unfortunately, Jim's are very well documented. But, you know, I've been around Jimmy, I don't know how many times. He's the greatest, funniest guy in the world, man.
Yeah, obviously, I agree with you 100%. I've never had a single crossword with him in over 20 years. So,
it's not like, okay, you know, you do the show with him, the Jim Cornette Experience. It's not like, you know, the show ends and Jim turns into a different, you know, surly person. He's not like that at all. He's exactly who he is on his show.
I think people would actually be surprised at how happy and at peace he is, you know, when he's not on the air. He loves his life. I mean, he's not crazy about having to go on the road for anything, but when he's home, he is the happiest guy in the world, and nothing makes him happier than talking wrestling. And you could just lose yourself in a conversation with him.
Yeah, you can tell he absolutely loves it. He, you know, he doesn't like what's on now, and, you know, not all of us do. But I do remember we were at the Smoky Mountain Fan Week, and we were doing the shoot interview in 1994. I was the one asking all the really good questions, and I was sitting next to Stacy, who he barely knew at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's kind of a trip right there.
If I remember right, and again, I'm going back years and years now to when I was 14, I think you asked the question about what happened to Dennis Condrey.
Yes, I did.
That was still a big mystery, even in 1994, which is, you know, seven years after he left the Midnight Express. People still didn't know what happened.
I mean, it wasn't even relatively settled until when Dennis came back, like 2003 or whatever it was.
Yeah, that's right.
I still don't think it's ever been completely settled. There's a couple of stories out there, and who knows? Dennis has claimed that he just got tired of the road and decided to go home. And, you know, maybe that's true, maybe that's not. I don't know.
Well, wait, the second time?
The first time. The second time, we all know what happened. But, you know, it was, according to Jimmy, it was the weirdest thing in the world. One day he was there, the next day he was gone.
Yeah. Replaced by the fabulous one, Stan Lane. What did you think about that?
And that was an upset because the Fabulous Ones were still a top tag team. You're like, wow, Fabulous Ones are gone.
Yeah.
Well, hadn't Kern started to phase himself out a little bit in the previous couple months?
He had. He had gotten his real estate license. But you know how the wrestling business is. Everyone comes back, and, you know, exceptions are few and far between.
Yes.
So let's talk about something. Bix and I, before we started recording, asked you about something I had noticed. I found my old manila envelope that I got from you with your tape catalog, which was probably the best tape list of the time because –
Probably.
It definitely was because you didn't just list what was on the tapes. You wrote descriptions. They were funny at times. They were informative because if you – just started getting the Observer and didn't have back issues and didn't have any sort of catalog of information, you would find out a lot of things from the John McAdam tape catalog. And one of the things I noticed in there was you said that you thought Terry Taylor was, you know, this is, you wrote this in maybe 94 or 95. Terry Taylor was the most underrated talent in the history of the wrestling business. Let's talk a little bit about that. What do you think what do you think could have been done better with Terry Taylor?
Okay, here's what I heard about Terry Taylor and why his career kind of crashed and burned. Supposedly, in 1985, Dusty had a meeting with all of the talent, and he told them, look, if you're not happy with your push, you know, we'll let, I don't know if they had contracts or what, but we'll let you serve out your notice, we'll let you out of your contract if you think you can get a better push someplace else. Apparently, Taylor took that as, well, go ahead if you think you can go do better somewhere else. And Taylor stood up in the middle of the meeting and said, well, that's me. I'm out of here. I want out. Dusty never forgave him for that. He went back to Watts, and then when Watts dried up, now he's dealing with Dusty, who he has heat with. So Dusty didn't like him. He was too small for McMahon, at least in McMahon's own opinion, and those were the only two places to work, you know, and make decent money. So, again, this is all from what I've heard, but that's why his career crashed and burned. As far as, you know, Taylor as a talent, I mean, what couldn't he do? He could talk. He worked quite well as a babyface. He was outstanding as a heel in 87, in my opinion.
And 88.
You know, he was...
Yeah. World class in 88 against Chris Adams. That was tremendous.
That was a tremendous forgotten feud. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I look at this guy, you know, he's a good looking guy. He dresses well. I mean, if I had the book in Crockett in 88, I might have, and a lot of people are going to go, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. I might have used Terry Taylor as a catalyst to replace Ric Flair in the Horsemen, and that would make Ric Flair a babyface. Everyone's, and I hear y'all out there, you're saying, oh my God, this guy's crazy. This guy's going to fill Ric Flair's shoes. That's how highly I thought of Terry Taylor.
I think Ric Flair's argument would be less about filling his shoes, more that he wouldn't want to be babyface. He would have fought that tooth and nail at that time.
Well, you know, Bix, it sounds like you and I are the only people who understand that. And you know what? I would say this about any wrestler. You don't get to do whatever you want. The time had come where Rick needed to turn. He was killing baby faces because he was so over as the baby face.
Yeah, you know, to take a step back, you mentioned when he comes back to Watts after – or when he comes back, excuse me, to Crockett after Crockett buys the UWF. You know, what are you thinking at the time at that feud, the way it played out? What could have been and what it ended up being, the UWF versus NWA?
I mean, from what I was told from day one, Crockett and Dusty had no interest in the wrestlers. They were strictly out there buying the television spots.
Right.
Which, you know, they had an excellent syndicated network, and cable wasn't everything back then. As a matter of fact, syndication was still more important than cable. But it came right at a point where the NWA's top stars had begun to stale. And they absolutely needed an influx of top new talent. They had been on since April of 85. And did they, in the first 2 years, did they create any new stars whatsoever? Maybe they're forgetting someone. I mean, Luger got a huge push.
Yeah, but that's early 87. Luger comes in. Between 85 and 87, I'm trying to think. TA was already
there.
How
are you defining creating new stars? Because there are a few people. You could say like Rick Rude to a degree or someone like that, but not really.
Okay, yeah, there you go. Okay, there's a good example. But I mean, Rude, you know, he didn't get a main event push.
Right.
So, you know, it was almost like – so you've had the same guys on top for 2 years, and, you know, the influx of talent from the UWF would have benefited them greatly. And to use Dave Meltzer's term, they just treated them like stepchildren.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, they were loaded with talent. Obviously, Duggan and DiBiase both made the choice to go to the WWF. Steve Williams was having growing commitments with Japan. you know, but the Freebirds were in and out. The Freebirds, they probably should have done more to try to retain, even with Terry Gordy's Japan commitments. And, you know, they had Terry Taylor. They had Eddie Gilbert. They had Sting, who they would end up using and probably doing as good with at that time than anyone else would have done. But it's just like one of those lost things. I mean, the first night, they had Big Bubba go in there and destroy the one-man gang.
Well, Gang was leaving, too.
Had he already given notice at that time?
I think so.
Okay.
Oh, well, or is it the other way around? I'm not as far as chicken and the egg there. You might be right that it might have been the other way around. I'm not sure. Now that I think about it.
Yeah. Well, but here's the thing. Like, in 86, I thought they had Big Bubba Rogers ready for a main event push. I mean, you know, yeah. Dusty breaks a chair over his head. He no-sells it. The guy looks like a complete monster. And they screwed up his push by having him get pinned on television a couple of times. Now he's the UWF world champion. Well, he was a mid-carder for Crockett. So what message is that sending?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, on this topic of the UWF, let's talk a little bit about the formation of it, because Bix and I have discussed it on the show in the past. So late 85 Mid-South, you have Butch Reed, you have Slater and Buzz Sawyer, you have Jake Roberts, who was really over as a babyface, you have the Masked Superstar coming in, and, you know, by the time the UWF is up, you know, with the name change and the television change in early 86, Butch Reed's gone. Dick Murdoch, big star in Mid-South earlier that year, had just done the big angle with Ted DiBiase on TV, maybe the greatest one-hour episode of wrestling ever. He's gone. All these guys are gone. Do you think that had a negative – do you think that caused any problems with the crowds?
It had to have. Right. I mean, we're talking, you know, they did lose a lot of major stars. I think they were putting a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for, stock in the Freebirds when they came in May 86. And the Freebirds, it almost felt like the act had been worn out a little bit. Like the fans in that area had seen enough of the Freebirds in that role. But yeah, you know, losing Jake Roberts and all those guys, I mean, yeah, definitely hurt. Butch Reed, in my opinion, had enough talent and charisma to be NWA champion or maybe even WWF champion. And I have heard Butch was having his own problems then. That's what got in the way.
I've heard that story too, that his wife said he had to move home to Kansas City, and that's why he ended up going to work for Bob Geigel to straighten his life out.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And it just, I love that era of those shows in early 86, and it just changes. And then, I mean, I do like the Freebirds in the UWF because it's a stale role for them as far, sort of, but they really did good work as far as the fresh group of baby faces they were working with. Now, whether or not in the climate of wrestling at that point, they were necessarily guys that you give $100,000 each guaranteed contracts to, I don't know. But I don't think it was a bad move to bring them in. To just bring in everyone from World Class was probably not a good idea.
Yeah. And then go into Dallas or Fort Worth, excuse me.
Yes.
You know, and I hope it's not misunderstood. I'm not saying anything bad about the Freebirds. I was a huge fan of theirs. Just as draws in Mid-South, I mean, they were considered a disappointment. And it might have had a lot more to do with just them. So.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine Butch Reed still there as a babyface to be able to be worked into a program with the Freebirds. Because it seems like everything that year was DiBiase, Terry Taylor, Duggan, and Doc when he was around. It's just it was those four.
Against the Freebirds.
Yeah. Against the Freebirds. You know? So just if Butch Reed was there, it would have been a game changer.
Well, you forgot to mention Bill Watts.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The Cowboy. You know, the Last Stampede was the biggest thing they ever did in the history of Mid-South Wrestling, the biggest run they ever had. And then there was the Stampedes Alive in 85, which, you know, didn't do as well. And then he came back against Korstia Korchenko. And then later
the worst
that year,
Russian ever.
The worst Russian ever. And then later that year, they do another thing with him and the Freebirds. It was just diminishing returns.
Korchenko, I think you're giving him too much credit when you call him the worst Russian ever. He might have been the worst wrestler ever, and I'm not exaggerating. Show me a wrestler worse that got pushed that's worse than Korchenko. But yeah, Watts, you know, I love Bill Watts, a ton of respect for the guy, but he just looked too damn old out there. And you're right, they went back to him one too many times.
He was actually still pretty good in the ring, though. I think he holds up his end of those matches well, all those six-man tags and stuff.
I mean, he wasn't bad, but I think when you look back, every promotion is doing this, and I honestly believe that when one promotion does it, especially when they're on TV and you can see them, it negatively impacts the other promotion. Like Bill Watts gets thrown in there with, oh my God, they brought back Vern Gagne, they brought back Fritz Von Erich, now they're bringing back this guy.
Right, yeah, even though he was more credible than the others, it gets lumped in.
Yeah, he does. And, you know, like I said, in my own opinion, he looked too old to be out there main eventing and having, you know, Terry Gordy go flying when Bill Watts throws a punch at him.
So that was a lot of fun and a little different than what we're used to here on the show. Just a nice, long, flowing conversation, kind of the conversations me and you have had on the show, Bix, but we incorporated a third person. And that was a lot of fun. We hit on a lot of stuff. Some of his observations and remembrances of hanging around Dave Meltzer and going to those old shows, you know, in Philadelphia or Baltimore or Boston for that matter, and all the different things, just great stories all around.
Yes, although I get the feeling it's going to reinforce a lot of people's negative stereotypes about Boston.
Why do you say that?
Because of all the things he said about the Boston Garden, and then when we talked about the first WWF Foxborough Stadium show, where the crowd is all drunks fighting, that the wrestlers stop their working their matches to watch.
See, I love that kind of stuff.
See, I do too, but I'm saying there are people who are not going to think highly of Boston as a result.
Oh, it was years ago. I thought people aren't going to think highly of Kowalski when they hear about what a dick he was to John.
That surprised me, to be honest.
Yeah, that's and John's an honest guy, so I totally believe that that's the truth. That's a bit dickish, gotta say, to the late kill. I hate to speak ill of the dead,
but that's we all do.
But that was a bit dickish. So anyway, we'll be having John on again at a future time, and I want to thank him. He gave us a lot of time. He's really generous. Did the Dentist of the Week with us this week. And also, we just spoke for a long, long time, and that's what you just heard. Also want to thank Jamie Ward. Jamie was on the show last week with the Dentist of the Week, and he returned this week to tell us the Nate the Rat story. Thank him. And two really good guys. And it's really neat talking to these guys, this class of smart fans from the 80s. From the, you know, they both attended the UAWF convention in 88 in Memphis. And that's like a who's who of wrestling fans at the time. Wade Keller, Dave Meltzer, Eddie Gilbert, Paul Heyman, just, you know, everyone was there. So really, really cool to spend time talking with them, Bix.
Yeah, it's weird thinking of Heyman and Gilbert in a fan context that late, though.
You know what? It's not as hard thinking of Eddie in that context. It's
no.
Hard to think of Heyman just because, as we talked about with someone for a future episode, Heyman was an obnoxious guy and hard to be around even when he was a kid. So... So we'll be having more about that next week on the show. We will have part three of our discussion with Bobby Simmons about Georgia Championship Wrestling. Really cool stuff. You'll hear lots of stories about different wrestlers who work there, about his thoughts on some of the bookers who work there. I think everyone will really enjoy that. And next week we'll have, of course, the Dentist of the Week. And we may have part one of a discussion with someone else. We got to go through the tapes and see how we want to divide it up. I don't know if we should say it yet. Maybe we should hold off until
just tease that it's coming, not necessarily when.
Okay, fine. I'll do that. Okay. Coming up will be a multi-part talk, probably. You know, probably multi-part.
Definitely.
With John Arezzi. And this is really, really cool. I know we hear from a lot of people who are like Bix and myself and grew up in New York, either on Long Island or in the city or in the Bronx or wherever. And you remember Pro Wrestling Spotlight. You remember John Arezzi's Weekend of Champions. And we had a long, fun talk with John. It was really great to talk with him. Both Bix and I called his show back in the day. You may remember me as a weird 14-year-old calling with a very deep voice. But it was really cool talk with him. And we hit on a number of topics. We hit on his radio shows, his conventions, his dealings with Dr. Mike Lano. For everyone who's been asking for Mike Lano stories, you're about to get maybe the greatest batch of them ever.
And they're stories from before he was Dr. Mike Lano.
Yes, he was just fanboy oddity Mike Lano at that point. You'll hear about Herb Abrams. You'll hear about the WWF steroid controversy and sex scandals when John was on Donahue, when John was actively doing his radio show exposing what was going on in the world of wrestling. You hear about the time he was a job guy for the WWF in the late 70s, WWWF.
With no training whatsoever.
With no training, which, you know, we'll have the video on our video playlist so everyone can see that. And you'll also hear about, as Ron Scholar talked about, the attempt to get him to play Papucho, Cutie Pie, the Cupid character for Antonio Pena's AAA. That and so much more. It was, tell me what you think, Bix. I think it was just such a delight and so much fun to speak to John about all the things we did. It was really, really cool.
Oh, very much so. And one thing that I think will really stand out to people is just how candid he was, especially since a lot of it was not really prompted by us.
No, I think John's been away from the wrestling business for a long time, and John is at a point in his life where he's very happy and he's done well for himself, and he can look back on wrestling and very honestly acknowledge his mistakes.
Vince Russo.
That's another thing we'll be talking about. Yes. He got Vince Russo into the wrestling business. But beyond Vince Russo, he's made mistakes. He did things right. There are things he wished he hadn't done that he wished he could change. He's very, very honest and very, very candid. And again, if you grew up in New York listening to Pro Wrestling Spotlight, if you grew up listening to John Arezzi on the radio or going to the Weekend of Champions conventions he did every year, you are going to want to listen to this.
Or even if you're a Pro Wrestling Torch VIP subscriber and you've been listening to the Pro Wrestling Spotlight shows in the archives, if that's your first glimpse of those shows.
That's right. And, you know, I would say that I think anyone could have John Arezzi on their show, although I'm not sure he would do anyone's show, but anyone could have him on. But the fact that we got to talk to him and we were listeners and we're from New York, I think we did something special with him that no one else would be able to touch. And everyone's going to really like that. So that'll be coming. That'll be in the coming weeks, as Mark Aline would say. How would Mark Aline say it, Bix?
I had my screen off and I did not expect you to. Get into
that. Well, let me hear you do a Mark Aline voice. Do me that favor.
Wait, I gotta do my vocal exercises first. Let's see. All right, here's my Mark Aline impression.
You will see him in the coming week.
That was lame. I want to hear you do it.
That was me doing it.
Oh, bullshit. Come on. Try it. Try a voice. You've never done a voice on the show.
Yes, I have, and they've all been terrible.
What voice have you done?
I've tried. Unless have those all been on Between the Sheets somehow?
Try Mark Aline.
No.
Try a voice.
Try
the Black Scorpion.
No, because I'll end up getting laryngitis.
Try Denim Fritz.
No, because I'll end up getting laryngitis.
Try Sue the Shooter.
No, because then someone will use it against me in the future for blackmail.
He's not kidding. He's not kidding. Come on, try Mark Aline. Try any
Do rest. I have to say, no, but specifically, do I have to say you will see him in the coming week?
I want you don't have, if you will do Mark Aline, you could say anything that Mark Aline would say. It doesn't have to be that phrase.
Okay. But it has to be Mark Aline?
Or it could be if there's another wrestling character or person around wrestling who you think you can, you could do any voice right now.
Okay.
It just has to be someone.
No, I'll do Aline because it's on my mind. Okay. This is going to be terrible.
I hope so.
Okay. I'm acknowledging this is going to be terrible, so let's see. You will see him in the coming week.
You know, it was, but it wasn't as bad as I thought it would have been.
Okay. So, like, I had a lot of time to prepare.
Yeah. No, you did enough vocal exercises there, but you will see John Arezzi in the coming weeks here on the show. How would Mark Aline say it, Bix?
You will see him in the coming week.
John Arezzi from Pro Wrestling Spotlight. And with that, I think it's time for plugs. Oh, and remember, in 2 weeks, tell a friend, call somebody, as they would say back in the old days. Michael Hayes, 1988, Dallas, Texas radio, will be right here on 605. Part two of our Michael Hayes radio series in 2 weeks here on 605.
That is exciting. Does he talk about Steve Do-It-To-It-Cox, or is this before they teamed up?
He does not mention Steve.
Oh, because it's plugging the concert, so it's before they teamed up.
He's plugging the famous concert where he was going to have the Von Erichs sing backing vocals before he was attacked, which is one of the greatest what-ifs in wrestling history. What if the Von Erichs had got on the mic and sang? Oh, boy. Well, that'll be in 2 weeks here on the show. Bix, what do you got to plug this week?
I'm not even sure anymore.
You're not sure anymore?
You go first. Because you know what? You're going to need some time for your plug this week. I think we discussed earlier, because I'm curious to hear about what's going on the Cornette Show this week, based on the hints you dropped.
Well, let me say a few things. If you've been listening to this show, you've kind of gotten a chance to know me and know Bix and know what kind of person I am and you know, what kind of guy I am. I like to have fun. I'm pretty laid back. I like to laugh about things. And I was on the Cornette Show a couple weeks ago, and I gave my observations about WrestleMania, and someone had a problem with what I had to say about Chris Jericho, that I'm not really a big fan of him anymore. I used to be, and I talked about various things. And this person wrote about it on Twitter and called me a bunch of names. And this person was Lance Storm, Cunty Lance Storm, as he's now referred to in my world. And he called me a bunch of names for no good reason. I mean, he could have disagreed with me. He didn't have to call me names. And I didn't respond. I didn't say anything. Actually, one of the coolest things that's ever happened, I didn't even know about it because I don't follow Lance Storm on Twitter because there's nothing he has to say of any importance. And I didn't find out about it until I was tagged in the reply someone made to go out and defend me. And the person who defended me against Lance Storm, this was like my favorite moment in the history of the show, was Yo Mamba the Jungle Savage. So all of a sudden, in the middle of whatever Lance Storm wrote, I see like, Yo Mamba don't like Lance. Brian's good. Yo Mamba eat Lance. Whatever the thing said. So I want to thank whoever it is out there who does the Yo Mamba Twitter page. Thank you for coming to my defense. I appreciate it. But Lance Storm hit me, and I've never been real big on bullies. And I see that as a bullying tactic. I see that as, you know, really underhanded. So I had a few words to say about him this week on the Jim Cornette Experience, right at the very beginning. It's maybe one of the best Jim Cornette experiences ever, not even because of that, but Bix, we had, it was well over an hour, I think, conversation with Ricky Morton. I shouldn't say we. I got one question in and nothing else. And I don't even mind, because the conversation between Cornette and Ricky is just illuminating. It's amazing. It's so much fun. I think everyone's going to really go crazy for that. But at the beginning of the show, you'll hear my response to Cunty Lance Storm. And let me just say, as I say on there, if you listen to the show and you know me, you know what kind of guy I am. I didn't appreciate Lance Storm coming out there and just calling me names for no reason. What a wimp. What just a total internet wimp Lance Storm is, besides being a crappy professional wrestler. So you can hear that and more on the Jim Cornette Experience on MLWRadio.com and iTunes. And that's all I have for my personal plugs this week. Bix, what do you have?
I'd just like to point out that those comments do not reflect the views of the 605 Super Podcast.
Oh, yes, they do. Oh, yes, they do. Oh, yes, they do. They reflect 605. They may not reflect David Bixenspan, if that's what you want to say, but they reflect this show.
Okay, that's fine. That's fair. That's fair.
if someone hits me or you, they get hit back. And that's that. You know, I didn't start anything, but I'll sure be the one to finish it.
Although having seen Lance hit people, I don't know if you really needed to hit back as hard as you did.
You know what?
That was a joke about him working. Forget it.
Yeah, I know. But you haven't heard it yet. I didn't hit him that hard. I could have hit him a whole lot harder. And I held back. And I was pretty nice about it. All things considered, I was pretty nice about it, because I really, really could have hit him a lot harder. Trust me. Believe me. I could have hit him a lot harder. And I didn't. So that's that. But the views...
I could have hit him in a lot harder, and I didn't. The story of Lance Storm's career.
Yeah. Well, the views I express on there reflect Brian Last and the 605 Super Podcast. Maybe not David Bixenspan, though. But Bix, what do you got this week?
All right. This week on Between the Sheets, we're covering 1994, and our guest is an old friend of mine, as well as yours, Hangman Tim Knoll.
Don't call him the Hangman. That's a curse.
Well...
Do you say hang in there when you talk to him, like Bruce Pobans? By the way,
I would never.
Let me cut you off here, Bix. I got a file of Bruce Pobans stuff someone sent me.
Do tell.
Articles, all sorts of posts that he made, articles, text captures, web archives, source archives. I'm just looking at the file names here.
Okay, you have to send this to me immediately.
Yeah, so maybe there'll be more about the Hangman Bruce Poe bands on a future episode, because I got like a wealth of information here.
But yeah, Cauliflower Alley is going on. We should probably ask some of our friends who are there if that hangman is in attendance.
There's no way he's there. There's no way.
Did he stop going at some point?
I thought he had after everyone confronted him, but maybe I'm wrong.
Okay. Well,
but anyway, back to your plug. I'm sorry.
The superior of those two hangmen, hangman of the Mid-Atlantic region, Tim Knoll, is on as our guest covering This Week in History in 1994, including, among other stories, some movement in the WWF upcoming steroid trial and some charges that were dropped. All Japan women negotiating with Tonya Harding, which is one of my favorite stories, and was a bigger mainstream story than people remember, I feel like, because that got a lot of press. The end of the Heavenly Bodies in Smoky Mountain Wrestling with their last episode after losing the Loser Leaves Town match to the Rock and Roll Express. The lead up into the Champion Carnival Finals in All Japan and the New Japan Super J Cup, which were the following week.
Triple Jesus A- Christ, this plug is longer than the fucking show.
Have you listened? No, it would take a lot to be longer than that show.
Okay.
Well, it's a loaded week, too. AAA and UWA start working together in Mexico. Lots of stuff going on that week. So that is on Between the Sheets at the PWO-PTPN Podcast Network, which you can find on iTunes and other podcast providers by looking for PWO-PTBN.
Yeah, not enough initials. Add some more.
UWF, IWA.
You have anything else for your personal plugs, Bix, or should we move on to the show plugs?
I don't think I've got anything else of too much note this week. I had another Hogan-related thing up on Death and Taxes, but otherwise, I think I'm good for this week. I mean, if I think of anything, you know, just follow me on Twitter, @DavidBix. We'll plug our Twitters again when we're done, but yeah.
As we said earlier, you could use our Amazon referral link and we get a little bit of a kickback. It's a way to support the show and help us out. It is tinyurl.com/605Amazon. And if you want to try Amazon Prime, there's no commitment. You can try it for 30 days for free, no charge, and we still get a kickback. It is tinyurl.com/605Prime. So do that, please, and support the show. Also, if you happen to be sitting on a large amount of cash and you'd like to donate to the show because you really love the work we're doing, at the bottom of each post on 605pod.com, there is a donation tab for Bix and myself. You can go there and you could donate money to the show. You know, just a way to support the show. If you have it, that'd be great. If you don't have it, don't do it. But if you have lots of money, you know, hey, if you're a multimillionaire and you got money and we entertain you, hook a brother up. That's what I say. On Facebook, maybe my favorite thing with this show is this growing Facebook community. It is facebook.com/superpodcast. Every week on there, we put up different artwork, different pictures, videos, old articles, all sorts of stuff. And everyone who participates on there, I got to say, I love you guys. You guys have just been so awesome. You know, there's a lot of regulars. There's a lot of people who just chime in every now and then. But you've really made this into something. It's a growing community. And I'm just really, really happy to be a part of it. And I try to respond to everyone as soon as I can. And you guys are like the rock stars of this show. So thank you, everyone on the Facebook page, for participating. And on iTunes, the thing that Bix used to make fun of me for forgetting, you can leave a 5-star review and write a review for this show on iTunes. And it's something we really, really do appreciate. And it's something that, how does it help us out again exactly, Bix?
If we were to get into rankings, it helps when you have a higher, like when you have more reviews and a higher rating.
Rankings. Okay. Like a top 10, they have their own top 10 as opposed to our super universe, super podcast.
Did you see, by the way, when they took the votes for the top wrestling podcast, it was only like a couple hours long. And then like, this was allegedly a Twitter vote for them to start a pro wrestling podcast page, which also completely ripped off the Pro Wrestling Plus logo for some reason from TSN.
I don't know. I didn't really follow it.
But anyway, it included Roddy Piper's podcast.
Okay.
Roddy Piper died, I believe, close to 10 months ago now.
Was Bruiser Brody's podcast on there too?
Jeez. No, but Adrian Adonis's was.
Okay. Well, here's...
But yeah, my point being, though, that podcast was also gone about 2 months before he died. So I don't understand it. Also, I did want to point out with Facebook, as always, Brian posts the artwork that our friend Travis Heckle does for the show.
Oh, he's an all-star.
Last week, he put together quite possibly my favorite to date. We played the clip when we were talking about wrestlers doing promos about steroids of Phil Hickerson telling the Blade Runners that the only thing they know how to do is pump steroids into dem booties, as he would say. And Travis made one of the Blade Runner, I guess, what would you say, dancing?
Shimmying?
I would say dancing.
Okay.
Like, almost like butt to butt, with needles sticking out, but maybe that's how you dance over each other.
I've never danced like that in my life.
Not, well, they look like they're kind of, like, sort of in a disco-like position. And they have needles, syringes sticking out that cross over each other and form an X, and there's lightning, and it says steroid booty, and I can't do it justice, so just go to facebook.com/superpodcast, and you will see, and this is... Something about it is my favorite piece that Travis has done so far.
Yeah, it's great, and he does great work. And, you know, there are a few people who help us out each and every week. Travis Heckle does our artwork. Alan Blackstock does our video playlist, and we're very thankful for them and very thankful for all the listeners continuing to support the show. Here's our iTunes review of the week. It is from Ultimo K. Great show. If you love crazy, obscure wrestling knowledge, then you'll love this show. Santo Gold, Santo Gold. Thank you for that review. Thank you for throwing Santo Gold in there. That makes my day. And,
well, I saw someone at Pro Wrestling Only say that it seems almost like that's becoming our Baba Booey.
Yeah, you know, that we have a lot of different things that you could say is, you know, our thing. You know, the Slip House Boys, Santo Gold. I feel like we've taken over Marceline. I just heard that Brian Alvarez and Vinny had Marceline clips on their show, which I didn't know about.
Oh, really?
Yeah, apparently they played the interview at some point on Figure Four Daily, but I think that's kind of our thing. But I'm not saying that in a negative way, but I heard that they had it on their show, too. I don't know timing-wise when it was on there, but someone hit me up and said, hey, I heard this on there, too. So I really don't know. But anyway, you guys, the show has been growing each and every week. We just had another record-setting week where not only was the whole week a record-setting week as a total, but each and every day of the week set a new record. And, you know, I'm very grateful, very thankful. And it definitely helps motivate us to keep going and keep getting better and better and doing more and more for this show. This show has just been a runaway success so far, and it hasn't hit any sort of plateau. It's just still building and building and building. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. Sincerely, thank you. Bix, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, from the bottom of my heart, from the bottom of his foot, we say
from the bottom of my cold black heart.
Racist.
What?
On Twitter, you can follow Bix at David Bix. You can follow me at Great Brian Last, and you can follow the show itself at 605 Pod. As Bix has said in the past, it's mostly for utilitarian need. But it's not necessarily something that's, you know, over the top. But you can please follow us there, too. But follow our personal Twitters if you really want to see us writing stuff all the time. And with that, I believe we're just about done with the show this week. Santo Gold, Santo Gold. Bix, fun show?
Verily.
Boy, you're on a roll at the end of the show here. That's it for this week. Until next week, he's David Bixenspan. I'm the Great Brian Last.
And I'm Sue the Shooter.
And we are the Slip House Boys.
Saying tally-ho!
My master plan is just about to unfold. For years, you simple-minded peons in the street have called me Nate the Rat. Now you understand why they call me Nate the Rat. It's because I sleep with the rats. I eat with rats, and I drink with rats because they're my friends. They understand me. And now, Vincent, the time has come near for the grave digger to appear, for him to meet the self-proclaimed king of professional wrestling, Jerry Lawler. I hate your guts. And my friend, don't you hate Jerry Lawler? He hates you too, Jerry Lawler. And he hates that little stringy-headed, bleached blonde punk, Jeff Jarrett. I hate your guts. And my friends hate your guts. Don't you hate his guts too? And we're going to take that little sawed-off Elvis Presley impersonator, Bill Dundee. I hate his guts. And my friend Vincent, here, he hates your guts too. And then the grave digger is going to come. He's going to come and eat, and he's going to put you in your grave. And then my friends Vincent and his friends and all of my family will eat the flesh right off of your stinking body, and I will have the last laugh.